Good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday committee meetings. I think the meeting is called to order. Before proceeding with any business, though, I think Commissioner Duggins had something he wanted to say, so we'll let him start before Mr. Smith has his thing.
I've been living in fear of lawsuits ever since the spring bass fishing tournament that Dan and his bunch put on when I borrowed Mr. Parker's pen.
Lawyers are always working out lawsuits.
There was a failure on somebody's part to get the pen back to Mr. Parker. But thanks to the good work of Commissioner Friedkin and his staff, the pen has been located and on the record that they want to return it.
Thank you.
We're going to have something to do with losing it.
So, John, are you now going to indemnify him that you own it? We'll get into all that legal mumbo-jumbo back and forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bryant, can you and I have a conversation?
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming this morning. Obviously, kind of interesting times and went on in the world, literally the world, and of course the election yesterday and last night, and we'll see what comes out of all of that, but we're going to hold our regular meetings, committee meetings today, and our open meeting tomorrow, so I welcome everybody, and with that, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official minutes of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We will begin with our Regs Committee. Commissioner Friedkin, please call your committee to work.
First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes. It's already been distributed. Motion for approval.
So moved.
Bivens, second by somebody.
Somebody.
All in favor?
Aye.
None, motion carries. Committee item number one, update on parcel and lot progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resource Conservation Regulation Plan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. Saturday was an opening day deer season, and obviously that's a big time of year for us. Reports from our wildlife biologists and game wardens were a little slow around the state with the weather, big mass crop in a lot of places, too, that hampered deer activity, but looking forward to a good deer season. It was also, curiously enough, the opening day of the 54th Game Warden Academy. And so Scott and Pete and their team have got 55 new cadets at Hamilton County. It's going to be the first class going through the new Game Warden Training Center there. And so we're very, very excited about the development of that. Half of our cadets are males and half are females. So that's an interesting ratio there. And looking forward to seeing that class through the fruition over the next 7 months. And just as a reminder, Scott is leading a campaign with the foundation to help us with the fundraising there to complete that center. So we're very, very excited about that. I guess speaking on deer, in the last session, there were a number of interim committees that were charged to look into a number of things. There was a select interim committee that was charged with looking at deer breeding and how those business practices could be improved, what sort of marketing could be brought to the table to help that industry, what obstacles were there. They held their first committee meeting on the 1st of October. Mr. Bass is there to represent the Parks and Wildlife Department on that committee. Clayton Wolf did a great job testifying before that committee, and they talked about a wide range of subjects relating to just the health of the industry and business practices and disease issues and property rights-related concerns. So we'll report more on that as it unfolds. I guess the last thing that I will mention, and Scott has got a great presentation that he's going to share with us a little later on this morning, having to do with the impacts from Hurricane Ike, and so now we're going to hear a lot about the response from our various incentive teams on that front. One of the things we tried to do was be as flexible as possible with our constituents that were impacted by Hurricane Ike, and so, you know, one good manifestation of that was our coastal fisheries team. because of the huge amount of debris that was in the waters offshore and in the bays. We relaxed the restrictions on the turtle excluder devices through the 26th of October and instead put in place kind of limited trawl times there. And so to make sure that they weren't picking up any turtles by accident, but I think the shrimpers were appreciative of that change. So anyway, that's my report, Chairman.
Thank you,
Carter.
Appreciate it. Okay,
committee item number two, Rule Review, request permission to review rules. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel, and I'm actually going to do three presentations regarding our rule review process. Chapter 2001 of the Government Code requires that agencies review all their rules every 4 years. We have to include in that review an assessment of whether the reasons for adopting those rules continue to exist, and then we publish notice of our proposed review in the Texas Register for Public Comment, and then we either request that regulations be readopted, adopted with changes, or repealed based on the review. Normally, the review occurs over three meetings. First meeting, we request permission to begin the review. Second meeting, we request permission to publish changes as a result of the review in the Texas Register. Third meeting, we seek to adopt changes that have been proposed. This is a chart. You've seen this before with the schedule. Now we are looking at beginning the rule review process for Chapters 57, which is fisheries, and Chapter 65, wildlife. So staff requests permission to begin the rule review process for Chapters 57 and 65. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No further questions or discussions. I'll authorize staff to begin the rule review. Committee item number three, rule review, request permission to publish the proposed changes.
If you recall the last chart, for the record, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. We do this in a three-meeting process, and this is the second meeting for these rules, Chapter 53, Finance, 59, Parks, and 69, Resource Protection. 53, mainly Chapter 53, a bulk of that concerns fees. And in going through that, and I'm just going to put these up here, there were a number of permits and fees that were either duplicative, needed to be put in another chapter so that they're easier to find, or have been eliminated, no longer exist. And staff is proposing, recommending that we propose to make these changes. Parks had a number of changes as well. The entrance and use fees as a result of the fiscal control issues, those need to be updated. Use fees, same thing. Also, we need to delete references to the railroad. The chronology informatic organization, development guidelines, personnel selection and training, classification guidelines, all of those really basically need to be redone in order to just reflect current practices. For example, personnel selection and training, we now have the managing park operations training, fiscal control training that needs to be included. Development guidelines refers to the General Services Commission, which no longer exists, has been replaced by the Building and Procurement Commission. So for all of these, we're willing to update and reorganize. And then rules of conduct, again, same thing. For example, we want to address supervision of children, collection of firewood, things that we want to just make sure that we're clear about in the parks. On Chapter 69, Resource Protection, we're not requesting any proposed changes. So we're requesting permission to publish changes to Chapters 53 and 59. I listed 69 even though there are no changes being proposed. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
On this finance item 5312, have we never charged more to non-resident commercial boat fishermen than residents?
That is a good question. Thank you, Dalton. I don't know. Currently we don't. I'm not sure what it is. Currently we don't, but I'm not sure what the history has been on that. I can get that information for you.
I asked a question about 5312 and the changes. So it says eliminate duplicative language regarding commercial fishing boat fee and clarify there's only one license with the same fee for residents and non-residents, and I was asking, has that always been the case that we've had one fee, or have they ever charged more?
And I don't know the answer to that, but I can, we can actually Robin knows.
For the record, Robin Rogers with Coastal Fisheries. On that commercial boat fee, I think what we're trying to accomplish there is they're currently at the same cost, and we're just trying to merge those two together. They're relatively small cost anyhow on those, our relief is, at this point in time, since they are the same, we should just merge them together and do away with those two different license types on that particular one.
But to understand your question, it was whether historically they've been different.
Not in the recent past. It has not.
Is there a reason why out-of-state non-resident fishermen, commercial fishermen don't pay a higher fee?
Well, they do for this particular commercial boat license, for the non-resident shrimp license, non-resident oyster license, any of the actual licenses to prosecute a fishery in our waters, they actually do pay a higher fee. But the boat license was kind of a commercial, to get a total count of commercial licensing years and years ago. It's only used now, and Pete may be able to help me if there's a law enforcement reason, but I think it's used in the perspective of if you had some other vessel that was operating with one of those prosecution boats in some way, they would have to have that on board. They have to have it on board as well, but it's in some respects, it doesn't hold the same function it once did historically, which was to identify it as a commercial boat, and when we didn't have those other species-driven licenses at some point in time.
I assume you're asking from a financial point of view, should we charge more for non-residential than residential?
Yes, sir.
Is there any reason to or not to do that?
I have to admit, I don't remember the exact numbers on this, but I think our belief was it was a fairly small amount, and that, you know, at this point, the savings we will gain from a one license perspective versus the amount of money that was generated would probably be better off for us here. One of the things we could do here is make sure that we come back with all that information for y'all at the next meeting and the history behind this license a little bit so that you have a better handle on that.
That's why I was going to suggest, but I'm glad that Commissioner Duggan brought it up, because I feel like we probably have a significant number of boats being run in Texas waters out of Louisiana, and I know they run in the river over there between.
Okay, so for the next meeting, we come back with either a briefing or a little bit more information on how we're going to run.
We'll do that. Okay.
Got a question for Fran? Okay. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Maybe item number four. All right.
For the record, I'm Ann Brott, General Counsel. We're now to the third meeting of the three-meeting process for rule review on these rules. Chapters 51, 53, 55, and 61. In August, the Commission authorized staff to publish changes to the rules that were identified as part of the rule review process. These were published in the Texas Register on October 3rd. The proposed changes are for Chapter 51, Executive, to revise the petition for rulemaking provisions. First is to allow staff to deny a petition for rulemaking that is duplicative of a petition received and denied within the previous 6 months. To amend the petition for rulemaking process to address a situation in which staff believes staff's recommendation is that a petition be granted. And then to eliminate the requirement that staff verify that commissioners receive a petition for rulemaking. The reason for this final thing is that given the realities of modern communication, that usually happens anyway. I mean, we have faxes, we'll come back, return, and we'll come back, return, that sort of thing. And then to revise employee fundraising rules to more accurately reflect current agency practice. As you are aware, we changed that practice recently so that donations over $500 are approved monthly by the chairman of the commission and the chairman of the finance committee so that we can go ahead and start budgeting and expending those items. And then these donations are acknowledged by the commission at each meeting. And then on the Hunter education rules, to clarify that the required passing grade is 70 for in-person courses and 80 for online courses. On the public, and on 52, we want to change the title to stalking policy, which is more accurate. Law enforcement will know changes. Chapter 61, design and construction. This is original park program. A grant program, and we wanted to change the ranking system to track the changes to the other programs made in the previous rulemaking. And these have to do with things like whether the program supports the land and water recreation and conservation plan, that sort of thing, and then revise the definition of low income. On gifts to the department, we received 20 comments, 6 in favor, 1 against. The one against mainly was just concerned that persons making gifts to the department might have undue influence. On the petitions for rulemaking, we received 6 in favor, 0 against. We did receive one open records request for information about this proposal, but no comments. On the Hunter education, we received 19 in favor, 3 against, and all are apart. And the persons who commented against mainly believe that the passing grade should be the same for in-person and online courses. And in terms of the design and construction, we received 3 in favor, 1 against in part. And the 1 against really was not germane to this. They mainly expressed a concern about legislative earmarks. This is a recommendation that we'll be presenting to the commission tomorrow to adopt these changes as published in the October 3rd Texas Register. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What is the basis for establishing a passing grade of 80 versus a passing grade of 70?
We thought you might ask. Steve Hall is here, and he is our Hunter Education Coordinator. He's apparently it's an industry standard, and he's ready with an answer.
Steve Hall, Education Director, responsible for Hunter Education. Yeah, it's a national standard that the Internet providers use. 90% of the Internet providers for boater education, Hunter Education, and 100% for boater education use that standard nationally, and we're simply making a policy, a rule out of a policy.
But it's different than the other one. So
the in-person course is correct.
What's the rationale for the difference?
The difference is they're prepared, the higher standard for Internet prepares them better for the field course that they come and take a shorter field course, but it's a higher, more rigorous, you know, hands-on training episode, and so that higher standard prepares them a little better on the Internet side.
I think that's your question.
Right. And then also we've received correspondence regarding passing grades on other testing. Is there any way we could standardize the problem? I mean, I understand the difference in your Internet-based testing and your in-person testing, but is 70 the standard for passing on all in-person, regardless of what the testing protocol may be?
It's the primary standard. It's about 70% around the country that use 70% as a passing grade, and the others use 80% all the way through.
And specific references, we have some people in the audience today that are Falconers, and there's a Falconer test. And we received correspondence from someone regarding the requirements to pass that exam at an 80 percentile level rather than a 70 percentile level. And I don't know, I assume that was an in-person exam, but I don't know if it was or not.
I can't comment on that other than to say that the education standards are typically Internet 80%. In-person fluctuates. It depends really on what the nature of the topic is usually.
We can provide more information on that if you'd like.
That's fine. Thank you.
Any questions for him? Okay.
Committee item number 5, threatened and endangered non-game species regulations amendment. For Mr. Public request.
Good morning, Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. With me this morning is Dr. Gary Garrett in our Inland Fisheries Division. We're going to talk to you today about our threatened and endangered species regulations and some proposed amendments. Texas endangered species are handled under Chapter 68. Endangered species are those that are designated by the federal government or listed as threatened with statewide extinction by our executive director. And for your information, there are no state-listed endangered species currently that are not already federally listed. A 60-day notice is required prior to filing this list with the Texas Secretary of State. Now, threatened species are handled under Chapter 67, which is our non-game species regulation. Threatened species are defined as those likely to become endangered in the future, and these are handled under the Administrative Procedure Act, in which a 30-day notice is required prior to adoption by the Commission. Our proposed amendment would be to include the list of federally endangered species in the same subchapter of Texas Administrative Code as the state threatened list. At the same time, we want to remove the Arctic peregrine falcon from the threatened species list. This bird was delisted several years ago, and we are following suit with our state threatened list. And also to add the San Felipe gambusia to the threatened species list. In your packet, you will find both the endangered and threatened lists. And just also for your information, Louisiana pine snake was left off the threatened species list erroneously. We want to make sure that that snake gets back on the list if we go to publish in the Texas Register. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Garrett to tell you a little bit about this unique fish.
Good morning. Actually, I had the good fortune to discover and name this fish a few years ago. I named it after the most famous ichthyologist in Texas, Dr. Clark Hubbs. It's a mosquito fish. That means it eats mosquito larvae for a living, so it's fairly popular in a lot of areas. This fish, however, occurs only in San Felipe Creek in Del Rio. That's obviously an urban stream. It's about 10 miles long, fed by the third largest spring in the state, which makes it a fairly stable environment. Emanates on a golf course and flows through town. The total creek is about 10 miles long, and the gambusia, the San Felipe gambusia, occurs in about half of that habitat. So very restricted in its habitat. But very specific to that area, highly adapted for that area. We've worked with the City of Del Rio and the golf course over the years to develop a creek master plan to help them protect that that natural resource that they're very proud of in a way that that it will be there for a long time. It's designed to protect that natural ecosystem that allow the citizens to use it. And the mayor, the city council, the golf course staff are all very proud of what they've done. They're very proud of the fact that their work on this creek and working with Parks and Wildlife has enabled us to actually find this fish. This fish has been there forever. But I myself have collected in that area for like 30 years. Others, such as Clark Hubbs, for 70 years or so, fish has never shown up. Old museum collections never had this fish in it. After that devastating flood in 1998 in Del Rio, that occurred about the same time we were working with the city and the golf course staff to reduce pollution, fertilizers, things like that, to clean up the creek, make it a more natural environment. That flood came through, really flushed it out, and subsequent to that time, we discovered this fish, and it's actually in high numbers now. It's a testament to the good work that they've done in taking care of their natural resource. So they're very much in favor of everything they can do to protect this.
So the proposed amendment, we're requesting permission to publish the amendments as presented in the Texas Register for Public Comment. And I'll be happy to take questions at this time.
I'm just curious on the threatened list. I know we're delisting the Arctic peregrine, but it lists the peregrine falcon still on the Texas threatened list, and it was delisted in 99. And I know there is a population along the coast that's a little iffy, but I'm just curious if that's something that will change at all.
We essentially have two subspecies of peregrines. We have the tundras, which is the one we want to delist today, and then the notum, which are the nesting birds in West Texas. And those are the ones we still believe need protection. Those populations are not doing as well. So we want to make sure that they have that protection. And they do through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and other regulations to protect them.
Any other questions? Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Thank you,
Eric.
Thank you.
All right, committee item number 6, Raptor Proclamation. Federal rules and the public request at that point.
Moving from fish to falcons. Again, for the record, my name is Matt Wagner, Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. We have an amendment to our Raptor Proclamation we'd like to tell you about this morning. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has recently authorized falconers to engage in abatement activities using raptors to control nuisance pigeons, grackles, and other birds. This federal abatement permit allows falconers to possess raptors for abatement purposes in addition to raptors possessed for falconry purposes. So the proposed amendment would be to Section 65 of the Texas Administrative Code to allow possession of additional raptors by licensed falconers for purposes authorized by a federal abatement permit. So staff requests permission to publish the amendment as presented in the Texas Register for Public Comment. And I can take any questions.
Basically, the consistency with the federal.
That's right. We want to make sure that this activity can proceed and we don't have anything in our state rules that would conflict with it.
Curious, how many falconry permits do we have in the state?
We have roughly about 200 permitted falconers. In fact, several members of the Texas Hawking Association with us this morning, and we work closely with them. We have a falconry and raptor council we meet with a couple of times a year to work out any issues that might arise. I believe there are only three or four that are actually permitted with this abatement permit currently. It's becoming quite a popular activity and effective.
What is that done?
Well, we know that in Fort Worth, some downtown Fort Worth, sure, some of that work's being done. Some airports, I think the DFW airport might recently been looking into this. If we have any more detail, I'd be happy to introduce some of these.
The grackles.
Sure.
Sheldon Nicole is with us, the Vice President of the Texas Hawking Association. If you have any more questions for him, I'd really like to turn it over to him.
Good morning, Commissioner Sheldon Nicole. The bird abatement is an age-old tried method of controlling nuisance birds. The changes that have come about just allow us to use captive bred birds. Historically, we've had the ability to use what they call exotics that are non-indigenous to the United States. And that's been a flourishing industry for years. And the feds have allowed us to use it with a special use permit. The new change just allows us to use the captive bred. And it's a very effective way. Texas has a Harris hawk, which I don't know if you're familiar with.
Yeah.
That bird is very effective with grackles. And I was actually last night flying my Harris hawk at DFW Airport. We got a contract that we started on Monday evening. Downtown Fort Worth, you might be familiar with what's going on there. We've been flying down there pro bono for 5 years because the permit wasn't in act, so we couldn't charge. And there's it's kind of an iffy statement, you know, it's charging to use your raptors. We were doing it just as a proof of concept with the mayor. Mayor Moncrief and a few others in downtown Fort Worth helped us in pushing through that federal permit. So it's very, I guess it's a successful way of controlling these birds.
How do we get to San Antonio?
You are. Brennan lives in Austin, but you know John Carter, who does our show. John did this years ago before these regulations, using exotics as well. So it's a tough industry. You have to stay on top of it, and it's not something that you go and do for an hour. In a lot of cases, it's an all-night activity, and you have to have numerous raptors, and I think the changes that Director Wagner is pushing through for us is how many birds does it take to do a job? Currently, the falconry regulations limit you to one bird as an apprentice, two as a general, and three as a master class falconer. One project may require 5 birds or 10 birds, and that's what the federal regulations allow us to do.
Thank you, Sheldon.
One of the questions, when you refer to exotics, what birds are you talking about?
Lanner falcons from Africa, there's a list of them, a whole list, but the lanner falcon from Africa is one of the most popular ones. They use them in California on the wineries, getting nuisance birds off their grapes. The saker falcon is another one that's considered exotic. It's just a non-indigenous raptor, and it's not indigenous to North America and protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty.
Interesting. Thank you.
You know what Commissioner Duggan is going to be doing on Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, no further questions or discussions. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Legislature required public comment period. Committee item number 7, 2009-2010, statewide initial proclamation treaty.
Favor.
Kicking it off with the
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Clay Bruin. I am currently serving as Acting Director of the Wildlife Division. I'm here along with Clayton Wolf to present potential regulation changes for the upcoming hunt season. I will present a couple of items for game birds, and Clayton will present a rather lengthy list for deer. The first is a briefing item concerning pheasants. If you will recall, at the January Commission meeting, staff agreed to investigate changing the current pheasant season structure by adding a week to the end of it. Now, since that time, staff, along with the Upland Game Bird Council, have met and discussed the issue, and at this time, staff, along with the council, recommend no changes to the current pheasant season structure. And I know that there's still a considerable amount of discussion on that item, and so any further direction or guidance that you guys can provide would be greatly appreciated. The next item is a proposed regulation change to the lesser prey chicken hunting season. Staff, along with the Upland Game Bird Council, recommend a suspension to the lesser prey chicken season as a result of continued population declines in Texas and range-wide. Now, these declines are associated with adverse impacts to habitat rather than hunting, and I want to make that very clear. Hunting is currently provided on a limited basis of a two-day season in October by permit only to landowners working under a wildlife management plan. And I will tell you that the suspension is intended to be a temporary thing. The ultimate goal is sustainable and huntable populations, and staff is in the process of developing a realistic recovery goal that will be presented to the commission in March. And the ultimate goal is to restore limited hunting opportunity again. I forgot to change my slides here. Before we move on to the deer proposals, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Do we go back to the pheasants? Obviously,
sure.
Why not extended for the week? What was the reasoning behind it?
Well, it was a number of issues. Declining, when I say habitat issues, that part of the world is experiencing declines in CRP primarily, expanded wind development, wind power development, and so a considerable amount of threats to that habitat, various things, but within, I would say, 10 years, 75% of the CRP contracts will expire, and it gets worse another 5 years after that. Another 5 years or so, it's 96% of the CRP contracts will expire. So we have definite concerns about that.
So with the wind and ethanol and all the rest of it, the CRP is going away.
Yes, sir.
Because there's incentives to do other things.
Yes, sir.
I also have a request that I would like to continue the pursuit of in our January meeting, in the discussions, the potential of actually opening the season a week earlier was also brought up. And I would like to put that out for public comment to see if the guiding community, as well as the public hunting community in the pheasant area, would appreciate the opportunity to be able to hunt pheasant on the week following Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Which would in opening it a week earlier would include that weekend. Now, I am also aware that there may be some issues with law enforcement in that coincides with the opening weekend of the mule deer season in the northern panhandle. And so I'm not trying to create an additional burden for these people, but I just want, I feel like it's our obligation to increase opportunities in any way we can. And I also understand the limiting factors that you just referred to with regard to wind energy and then the population increase in the panhandle, if nothing else. But it just seems to be able to include pheasant in that traditional hunting, family hunting period would be very well received by the hunting community if it can be done effectively within the confines of our law enforcement restrictions. And if knowing that that's going to take place, we remove people from an area that isn't high intensive into the panel just for that one weekend or just for the period that they need to be there, if that's practical. I'm once again not trying to.
If you wish. And protect the population, right, bird population, because that's one of the issues.
Morning, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, Colonel Peter Flores, Director of Law Enforcement. Commissioner, to answer your question, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The division's position is that we are for more hunter opportunity, obviously, and the more time that families get to spend out, we're for that.
Right.
But the division's position is it is a management issue, and we will take every step, proactive step that we can to provide for protection of our resources and be able to have wardens in the field to protect mule deer and pheasant and make it work. So we will do everything we can with our management to.
And I want this to be part of the comment process, obviously, not just public comment, but the department comment as well.
Yes.
It's an opportunity, I think, merits at least examination.
Yes, sir. Now, throughout the state, we work multiple seasons at any one time. It's a matter of prioritizing and moving and being able to answer the call.
Right.
It's all over the state, not just unique to the panhandle, but we will make this work.
Through our
supervisors up there and our workers at Can Do Bunch, and we'll do our best to serve.
Well, it's the busiest day at the Amarillo Airport is the Friday before the opening of pheasant season. And it's a big industry in the panhandle of Texas. And we need to take advantage of that fact with, of course, conservation always in mind. But it just seems like an opportunity that needs to be at least fleshed out.
We'll make it work.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it.
Yes, sir, Mike. I had a question on the, you made reference to the impact of wind energy. Are we doing ongoing scientific studies to document what the impact is ultimately going to be?
Yes, sir. We have several things going. In fact, you'll have a presentation later on this morning about wind development and some of the things we have going. So Kathy Boyston will be making a presentation later this morning.
Okay, in your view, the impact is it because the renewable or the wind energy is removing some of this wind from the CRP
issue.
Is that the impact, or is that an impact from birds flying into the
It's my understanding that the impacts are first the infrastructure. There's lots of road development, things like that, construction activities, then the structures themselves, and the information that we have on wind power is related to greater prairie chickens, that it was an adverse impact. So in Texas and what it's done specifically to the natural prairie chickens, we really don't have a whole lot of information right now. So that's where we stand on that issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Clayton Wolf. I'm the director of the Big Game Program, and as Clay indicated, I've got a rather long list of proposals, mostly dealing with white-tailed deer. This list has been 3 years or more in the making. But before I begin, what I would request to do is invite up Mitch Lockwood. Some of this laborious process of looking at how we count our animals and the populations of inference, we've gone through some dramatic changes since the science review in 2004. Mitch, along with our Whitetail Deer Committee, has worked diligently to look at a more biologically based units for counting deer, and we think it would be worth your time to see these changes. It will help you understand that when we show a group of counties, how we chose that group of counties for a particular proposal. So if you don't mind, I'll turn it over to Mitch.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm a Whitetail Deer Program Leader. And as Clayton indicated this morning, we'll discuss some basic principles of how and why we monitor deer populations in this state, and how we use those data to formulate harvest strategies to develop those, and which eventually result in regulation proposals. In response to the science review that was conducted in 2004 by the Wildlife Management Institute, we made many major changes to the way we monitor deer populations in this state. This morning we'll focus on the first and perhaps the most important of those changes, which was redefining the populations of inference. Prior to 2005, the white-tailed deer populations that we monitored in Texas were based on these political boundaries that we called reporting units. These reporting units were comprised of groups of counties that were considered to be somewhat similar with respect to general habitat types, what we did know about deer population parameters and harvest and whatnot. But quite frankly, we did not have a lot of data available at that time. There was some subjectivity that went into that decision-making process. And as a result, we did end up with quite a bit of variability in our data set, especially as a result of those political definitions, because as we all know, wild critters don't recognize those political boundaries. One of our goals was to reduce the amount of variability in our data set and to increase the confidence in our population estimates. In order for us to achieve this, we would have to abandon these politically defined management units, or reporting units rather, and adopt more of a biologically defined management unit that we now call resource management units, or RMU. So we began acquiring and analyzing spatial data, data regarding soil types, vegetation types, precipitation, land use practices, etc. We used the common resource areas defined by NRCS as our foundation, but then we used more recent data, on-the-ground knowledge, and we made some adjustments to those. We've already learned how this process is increasing the confidence in our population estimates, but we're continuing to make some minor adjustments to these delineations as we go. As we collect more data, we now have 4 years of population data with this approach, and the data are indicating some areas where some minor adjustments are necessary so we can reduce even more variability. And before we started this process, we were asked to explain the reasoning behind population and harvest monitoring. And I think that's a very important question. Our main goal with this effort is to evaluate the effects of our regulations on these populations. If we have, a liberal antlerless deer bag limit that we propose, if that were to result in over-harvest, we'd need to be able to identify that consequence and respond accordingly. Well, the only way for us to be able to achieve that goal is to have a consistent regulation throughout an entire resource management unit. as long as there's a single county that has a regulation of its own, a different regulation from the rest of the resource management unit, there's no way for us to evaluate the effect of either one of those regulations on that population. For this slide, I'd like to give an idea of how we're attempting to provide consistent hunting opportunities throughout an entire RMU. And if you look at those Orange counties, especially those, that stringer of Orange counties that stretch southwesterly from the Red River, they may appear a bit odd at first glance, especially when we're considering regulations based on political boundaries. But as you'll see with this next slide, these particular counties comprise an RMU, RMU 24. A lot of these slides that you'll see from this point forward, you'll see again with some more description in Clayton's presentation as he presents what we plan to propose. The different colors you see basically represent different harvest strategies or different proposals. In this case, the antlerless deer bag limit. But as I say, that group of counties is comprised of RMU 24. Now you can imagine there are many counties in the state. As you look at that fluorescent blue line there, that's the resource management unit we're talking about. There are many counties throughout this state that are comprised of multiple RMUs. So a decision must be made as to which RMU to assign a county to. Most cases, that's a pretty easy decision. But there are cases, in fact, here in the Blackman Prairies along the Red River provide a good example of when such an assignment is not so obvious. Let me show you with this example. Here we're looking at two RMUs, RMU 24 and to the east of that, RMU 22. The northeastern portion of RMU 22 extends into northern Grayson County, but by no means makes up the majority of that county. However, most of the habitat and most of the hunting activity occurs on the northern end of that county, and therefore, from a regulatory standpoint, Grayson County is assigned to RMU 22. Now, with this particular example, it doesn't really matter, because as you can see in those orange counties that are both east and west of Grayson County, we have a consistent regulation proposed in both RMUs 24, 22, and even 21 to the east. But the main point with this slide is that the county to which an RMU is assigned is not necessarily, or rather the RMU to which a county is assigned is not necessarily the RMU that makes up the bulk of that county. There are other considerations such as habitat availability, where hunting activity actually occurs, etc. With this slide, I'd like to give you an example of how we use data to monitor populations and react accordingly, how we formulate these harvest strategies or develop regulation proposals. As every one of you know, we've dealt with poor age structure among bucks throughout much of Texas for a long, long time, especially in the traditional one-buck county where there's been very heavy hunting pressure on bucks. Fortunately, this is improving, especially in much of East Texas, with some recent regulation changes that are allowing more immature bucks to age. However, we do still have a number of traditional one-buck counties with no other limits where we have heavy hunting pressure on bucks throughout the post-oak savannah, the Blackman Prairies, and the Cross Timbers and Prairies region. The western extent of this area where we have these age structure concerns among bucks includes RMU 24 that you see here, RMU 25, and RMU 26. As I said a while ago, you'll see some of these slides again with some more description in Clayton's presentation. But again, these colors that you're looking at are representing different proposed, or what we plan to propose, different harvest strategies. For example, blue counties in South Texas being a three-buck bag. Well, those yellow counties that you see there, And from this perspective, the RMUs that include those yellow counties are where we have age structure concerns among bucks. And you'll see a regulation proposal to increase hunting opportunity, but while also addressing this particular resource concern. But notice the western edge of that fluorescent blue line there of RMUs 25 and 26. Just to the west of that, you see a different color, kind of a beige tan color. So there, we would propose even more liberal buck bag limit, providing even more hunting opportunities, because quite frankly, in RMUs 27 and 29, we don't have these age structure concerns. Our data that we collect for these populations, the populations of interest that we define here, indicate no age structure concerns there. So no need for more restrictive harder strategies.
Can I stop you right there?
Yes, sir.
For obvious reasons. If I'm right on that edge, I mean, therein I assume lies some of the questions that come. RMU 24, 25, 26 versus 27, 29, I mean, theoretically they could split on somebody's ranch, correct?
They could.
Relative to the way that line is drawn.
That's right, they could. And that's one of the challenges that we have today is the inconsistency that we have. We're regulating by political boundaries,
right,
but monitoring populations by biological boundaries. That is a challenge that we have. But even though an RMU may split your ranch, we have, in the beginning of this process, made a decision, for the most part, an objective decision as to which county to which RMU to assign that particular county. So your whole ranch, being in one county, would have a consistent hunting regulation
with that county.
But currently, we do have similar examples that you bring up, where with the county defined regulation, your ranch could be in multiple counties, and you could have different bag limits across your ranch.
Yeah. Depending on the counties surrounding what RMU they're in.
Okay, so
that two different counties could have two different RMUs or requirements, and your ranch could be in both and be divided accordingly.
But even if,
right?
Well, RMUs aside, as it exists today and has forever, without even considering RMUs, you could have a ranch that is on a county line and you get in both counties.
Right.
One could be a one-buck county and one could be a two-buck
okay.
county.
Yeah.
Basically what you're saying.
Right.
But the same could exist with RMUs, but I think it still comes back to the point that we're at this point in time, we continue to regulate by political boundaries, and so that regulation will be set forth that county.
So at this point, if a ranch lives in two counties like that, we don't go to the more restrictive necessarily, but they can apply it for different parts of that ranch. Different parts of the ranch.
Clayton Wolf, for the record here, just the regulations would apply separately. The beauty in Texas is, number one, when we set our regulations, they're based on an average. And that means there are always exceptions out there. Fortunately, we've got our management deer permit program. So if we work with someone and they're just in the regulation package we have just doesn't work for their purposes, then we've got at least a safety net there with managed lands deer permits, and that would even include antler restrictions.
You could adjust accordingly.
That's correct, because basically with managed lands deer permits, the county bag limits do not apply. And so we do at least have somewhat of a safety net for those unique situations, and we use our regulations to manage the masses, what's generally occurring out there. But then we can also use our special permit programs for those exceptions, those unique situations.
And that kind of supports a point I wanted to make, is that we simply don't have the resources to monitor at any scale finer than this. We do recognize that there are ranches in this area of yellow that you see here that actually have pretty good age structure among bucks. They've been doing some good management for a while, and they're not representative of an RMU per se. And we know that occurs. And I think that's where our technical guidance program really kicks in, and where the managed land deer permits would better suit their needs.
And in our existing system, we're really looking for age structure above. We've got a lot of 1.5 to 2.5 year old concerns, right? So really, you're looking at a 3.5 to 4.5 above. How do we sort of define it?
That's correct. I'll get into that in my presentation real soon with some harvest data criteria.
And finally, we'll wrap this up and state point I want to make for this slide that we've already kind of touched on, and that's the challenges that we'll continue to face. The biggest of those challenges being the fact that there is that inconsistency between regulating by political boundary and monitoring by biological boundary. And again, to emphasize that this isn't a final product. It's really close. But we are continuing to modify, to make adjustments to these delineations as the data keep coming in, and it dictates some needs and areas for minor changes to remove some more variability from the data set. But this does conclude my presentation. I know this is a brief overview of a major project defining populations of interest and population monitoring and evaluating the effects of regulations. So if you have any questions or would like me to elaborate any more on it, I'll be glad to.
Very helpful question.
Yeah, you say we regulate by political boundaries, but with birds we don't necessarily do it by county boundaries, do we? We do it by highways.
That's correct. Well, with deer, we have some examples. With Highway 90, for example, separating a three-buck bag from a two-buck bag, there are a few examples where we have highways that are the boundary between two regulations. But with white-tailed deer in general, by and large, we're regulating by county.
So we can, if the study justifies, you could do it with a highway as opposed to a county boundary.
There has been, to answer your question, yes, legally we could. There's some discussion just in the beginning stages that we plan to discuss in much more detail of how feasible such project would even be. As you mentioned, highways, rivers could be a possible boundary, some other major land features, but that is something that has been tossed around and I think has enough merit to for further discussion on it.
Well, as an example, in the slide that has RMUs 24 through 26, I don't know which one is includes Stevens County.
24, I believe.
But anyway, Stevens County, the west side of that county, west of 183, is far different from the chopped up area east of that. And it seemed to me we ought to consider just looking at that one county as an example. Look at 183 as a dividing line rather than put the whole county in what's proposed here in the bag restriction. Has that been considered? Could it be considered?
I'd like to interject. Yes, it has been. In fact, we met with Carter Smith earlier, and he's given us a directive to look at trying to move these boundaries, our boundaries, closer to the more biologically defined boundaries. Of course, one of the big challenges we looked at that we're going to look at is making sure that we don't make it more confusing for hunters. I mean, obviously, hunters are used to counties now. And the other thing we want to look at is the inclusion of other species. You know, having a management unit for white-tailed deer that is not consistent with turkey or quail or some other species would add a layer of confusion. So Director Smith has asked us to get with our game bird programs. In fact, we're going to have a meeting this afternoon with our RDs and PDs and talk about this concept here and just see if it's feasible. So we are in the early stages here. We want to be very careful that, you know, whatever we do, we just don't make hunting tougher, you know, for folks out there hunting out there. But you are correct, and biologically, if we could get that regulatory boundary, whatever it is, closer. In fact, if the slide right here that Mitch was showing, you'll see just west of Bexar County there in San Antonio up on the screen, Highway 90, and you'll notice that those RMUs just north of that, or just north of Highway 90, obviously probably has something to do with building a highway where it was easy to build a highway, just like Interstate 35. And so there are some fairly easy boundaries where we do that already. And our regulations north of Highway 90 across those counties are different than south. And so we're going to progress forward looking at multiple species and seeing if that is feasible.
Mr. Our wildlife biologist has really done a phenomenal job in terms of working to enhance kind of the biological underpinnings behind these recommendations and how they set harvest criteria and regulations. I mean, the work they're doing is really cutting edge around the country. And I think Clayton captured it well, is it going to be possible to move these scales from the monitoring perspective to the regulatory perspective across multiple species, and are there discernible physical boundaries such as highway and other points of infrastructure that would allow for an easy demarcation of boundaries as opposed to the current county system? And obviously we just don't know that the answer to that. But I think the good news is the great science that they're bringing to bear here and thinking about this on a landscape scale perspective. It's, we're taking this
to some population dynamics.
Absolutely. Yep.
Because it's going to be the one way that you're going to be able to walk in and talk the political game. Because, I mean, that's going to be the issue at the end of the day. Okay. It won't be just highways or rivers and that kind of thing. It's going to be, you know, the county commissioners and, you know, we've been doing it this way since 1950 and, you know, all those kinds of things that happen. And so I want to give Clayton and all his group tremendous, the science that we're doing at TPW is second to none in the country. What we've talked about in Carter is behind 100% is if we do our science right, and our facts are correct, then, I would say this the right way, it makes it a little more difficult to argue then from just a political point of view, okay, if we're truly trying to do the right thing for the habitat, I mean for the population in the habitat. And so I give these two fellows credit. We're getting there. It's not easy, but we're getting there.
If there are more questions for Mitch, then I'll go ahead and continue with my presentation. And Commissioner Duggins, just to clarify, we are not ready right now for that project. When we talk about it, this is a big project, and we put folks on hold for 3 years on our regs package saying, please wait. And we were kind of nickel and diming folks with our deer regs. And that's why I'm going to be sitting up here a little bit longer and probably boring you. But we're not ready for that. That's our next step. And so the proposals that I will make today will still be based on these political boundaries, these county lines. And with that, I will go ahead and get started. And once again, just to clarify, this is your first view at this. Some of these slides will show proposals, but obviously we are not requesting permission to go to Texas Register at this point. We're running feedback on these proposals so that when we come back in January, we'll have a more refined proposal that we can show to you and request permission to go to the Texas Register. So this is just a first briefing. What we're looking at here, this slide before you is a slide of the current buck bag limits in Texas. And what I will do for many of these is do a progression from current to what our staff is anticipating would be a good proposal, a biologically sound proposal. And so I'll probably toggle back and forth a little bit. But if you'll see right now, we've got basically four different kinds of buck bag limit packages in Texas, anywhere from 1 to 3 bucks, and antler restrictions. Of course, with South Texas there being our most liberal. And then a little hodgepodge in East Texas of antler restrictions. What I will do when I progress to the next slide, I'm going to ask you to focus there on the western panhandle right now in those white counties. Those are currently closed seasons. And when we progress to that slide right there, I'll back up again, current to potentially the future. There are three counties there where we are proposing to open a season. They're currently closed, and we're proposing, or we would ask you to consider proposing opening a season for white-tailed deer. Those are Deaf Smith, Dawson, and Martin counties. Very limited deer numbers, but we think they can sustain some hunting, especially with the land ownership patterns out there. So in the other packages I show, you'll also note that with that there'll be an antlerless bag limit that we would anticipate or ask you to consider for those three counties as well. If you look there in the eastern rolling plains, they're just east of the panhandle, and I'll back up to current, and then when I go to what we would propose, you'll notice that we would propose to extend the 2 buck bag limit up through, and that's from, if you remember, that's RMUs, I believe, 27 and 29, all the way up to the Red River. As Mitch had indicated, different harvest characteristics, good age structure, can support a second buck in the bag limit. We actually, when staff sat down, they were actually thinking about taking the 2 buck bag limit all the way up to the panhandle. Because actually up in those 1 buck counties right now, the age structure in the panhandle is pretty good. But we do have an issue up there with a burgeoning deer population. There are some deer density problems in that area. Mitch took a tour up there with some of the field staff this last year, and they showed them around. There's some heavy utilization of the plant communities, and there's a need to harvest more antlerless deer. With that being said, when our staff looked at our big game harvest surveys, one thing we know about Texas hunters, and this is consistent throughout the Southeast, your average hunter kills between 1 or 2 deer, and that's it.
And our big game harvest survey also shows that there's a slight preference for bucks. So staff was concerned that if we added that 2-buck bag limit up through the panhandle, that there might be some negative impacts to antlers deer harvest. Now the reality is we really don't know. We really don't know based on our survey. So what we are anticipating or asking you to consider is that little stringer of counties there that we're going for 2-buck bag limit is also 1-buck. So we would have a group, we'd have some RMUs that are 1-buck going to 2-buck, and we'd have an RMU that's 1-buck staying at 1-buck with increased antlerless bag limits in both. And by doing that, we hope we might gain some insight and see if the second buck in the bag does that have a negative impact on antlerless harvest or not, because we really don't know. So it's kind of a field test. It's obviously not the best science in the world because, you know, we have little control over your controls, et cetera. But we've used our antler restrictions like this before to impose a restriction and then look at other similar counties and weigh the results. And so we have gained some insight. It's fairly coarse. And so we'd ask you to consider allowing us to propose the 2-buck bag limit up on the eastern rolling plains, but maintain it in the panhandle. That would focus on the east side of the state. Going back to current, you can see some 1-buck bag limits. Basically, this is what we consider, I guess, our last real bite at where we would go with antler restrictions. I'll go forward. One thing you'll notice down there in South Texas, just south of Bear County, this is current and this is proposed. That one county down there in the 3-buck zone is Atascosa County. Last year, we received a petition for rulemaking from folks in Atascosa County who were interested in the antler restrictions. Atascosa County is kind of split where the eastern edge has different harvest demographics than the western part. But anyhow, we basically, in our recommendation that you should have received, we asked to postpone until this package came up. And so we are also wanting to propose that in Atascosa County. And this is a result of a petition for rulemaking that we received over a year ago. As far as the question on the harvest demographics, all of these counties that you see there in yellow where we would propose antler restrictions, right now, unless they are under current antler restrictions or if they got antler restrictions recently, prior to the imposition or currently, 55% or more of the harvest is comprised of 1- and 2-year-old bucks in the harvest. And as Commissioner Friedman was indicating, there's a lot of harvest on the younger end. There's not many deer that are making it to the older age class. And just to kind of refresh your memory, this is a slide from our 6 original counties where we have had the antler restrictions the longest. A lot of bars there, but the take-home message is before we started, 75% of the harvest is 1- and 2-year-old deer. After 6 years, it's leveled out, and we see that 75% of the harvest is 3-year-old and older deer. And in fact, 40% of the harvest is 4.5-year-old and older deer. So big change in age structure. An important aspect to get here is we're also looking at hunting participation, youth hunting participation, to make sure that antler restrictions are not having a negative impact. And what we're seeing with all those demographics is that hunting participation is no different in these counties than it is in other counties without antler restrictions. We can't measure any difference, and we know some of our critics of antler restrictions were concerned about this complexity having a negative impact, as well we are. And so we've been tracking that. We have not been able to detect any negative implications as far as hunting participation, and we broke that down by youth and adult as well. As far as the antlerless deer bag limits, the slide before you shows the current antlerless deer bag limits in Texas. Most of Texas, except for South Texas, West Texas, and the Plateau, is a 2 antlerless bag limit. That's up to 2. And, of course, South Texas and the Edwards Plateau have up to 5. Now, I do want to reiterate that's a total deer bag limit of 5. So if a hunter chose to shoot all antlerless deer, then they wouldn't have any buck tags left. But they could opt for as many as 5, and then that's in conjunction with the buck bag limits that I showed you. On this particular slide here, I will progress forward. You're going to see up to the middle of the state, pretty dramatic, what we would propose is a dramatic increase in the liberalization of the antlerless bag limits. I just mentioned the need for more harvest in the eastern panhandle. This would increase the bag limit in the panhandle. and up through the cross timbers, and you'll even note this was one of the slides that Mitch showed you where that one RMU there kind of sticks out. The population demographics are a little bit different in that area. I'm backing up. This is current. Again, you'll also look in Trans-Pecos, and as we progress forward there in Terrell and Pecos and Upton counties, our staff has looked at that, both counties, and they see that that area also needs more analyst deer harvest, or at least can sustain it. Of course, in conjunction with the bag limits, we have days during the season when hunters are allowed to take antlerless deer without the need for a special permit. You'll see on the slide before you, for most of the middle of Texas, they can do that during the full season. You take a license tag and put it on a deer, and that's all you need. You do not need a permit of any kind. As you move into the eastern part of the state, we get more restrictive. We have some areas where there are only 4 days in the year. Some of those are antlerless by permit only. That's typically the Blackland Prairie and Post Oak Savannah. I'm going to progress to the next slide. In all cases, the changes you see are liberalizing the number of doe days. So there's an increase, a proposed increase from our staff in the number of doe days to that right there. Now, I would like to make one note. Yes, Commissioner?
I have a question. I probably should know the answer to it, but in areas that are closed, are we still allowing managed land programs to exist?
My understanding is no. The way the regs are written right now, there does have to be a deer season, an open deer season in that county. And so in some of these counties, for instance, in last year when this commission adopted the regs for mule deer seasons, we did have that question come up. By regulation, we did not have the ability to issue MLDs in these counties. Very small populations, but we propose to open the season so that folks could either hunt by regulations or by MLD. But the short answer is no. They cannot utilize MLDs if these have closed seasons.
Is that something we should consider?
But we can surely take a look at that and see if, obviously, if the commission has the authority, and we could look at that as an option. Yes, sir. Progress forward again here. These are the proposed days. I did answer your question, did I not?
Yes,
okay. So what we're looking at is a liberalization of doe days in Texas. One thing, if you look up along the Red River there, the one Orange County in the middle, that's Grayson County. Your commission materials that you have would actually show no change. In fact, if I back up one day, you'll see that right now Grayson County has 4 doe days. What we learned in retrospect is the 4 doe days are obviously there in conjunction with the archery only season that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. But what we recognize here of late is that in that RMU 21, the staff would recommend that it be regulated under RMU 21, which is antlerless by permit only. So that would be a correction to the materials you have. And I'm going to talk about Grayson County at the very end of my presentation because of a lot of interest we have in the archery regulations there right now. After the regular season closes on the first Sunday in January, we have late seasons in Texas. Those are muzzleloader, antlerless, and spike seasons, and it's also a regular modern firearm season. Of course, South Texas season closes 2 weeks later, so the season is later. Our staff would propose to enhance these seasons, add more counties, RMUs in counties, and so I'll progress to the next slide. One thing I would like to note is that the muzzleloader season starts the Saturday after the close of general season, so there's a 5-day period there where there's not a muzzleloader season. But on the antlerless and spike modern firearm, it begins the Monday after the close. There's a little bit of an inconsistency in our late season that we would like to address in addition to expanding opportunity. This slide is where our staff would propose to take the antlerless and spike season and the muzzleloader season. And in addition, we would hope to cut down confusion. We would propose to start all these seasons the Monday after the close of the general season and run for 14 consecutive days. The other thing that we noticed as we were looking at this is staff is proposing to put most muzzleloader seasons in some counties that are antlerless by permit only right now. Staff has some concerns about doing that, and so it would actually change our composition of the bag limit
And so what staff is proposing for muzzleloader seasons going forward, since this is really an additional opportunity and it's not really viewed as a tool for population control as it is with your modern firearm season, we would propose that for the modern firearms, ambulance and spike be the bag limits, remain the bag limits, but for our muzzleloader seasons that we go with the county regulations. And what that means is if there are doe days during the year, during the season, then it would be either sex. And what that would also mean is that we would remove the spike buck limitation and just propose that it be any legal buck. So really you're just looking at an extension of the deer season using muzzleloaders. And our youth-only season, this slide before you shows the days in green, which are our general firearm season this year, and the days in red, which are our youth-only deer weekends. Of course, October 25th and 26th have passed. January 17th and 18th of this of 2009 will be our youth-only deer season. You'll also notice there's that gap. Deer season closes, and then we have to wait 2 weeks before our youth season. What we would propose is to simply close the gap here. Now, we understand that a lot of those days are weekdays. Kids are in school or should be in school, I guess, unless they're homeschooled. We also know that, like, where I live in Fayetteville, a lot of those kids like to get out after school and go hunt a little bit, so there might be some use after school. But basically, we would like to propose the same philosophy in closing that gap between there and just running the youth season all the way up to the general firearm season. Maybe somebody gets out of school early on Friday and gets to go to the lease and hunt a little bit. And so we propose to close the gap and add a weekend. So all these seasons on the end, the muzzleloader, the antlers and spike, and the youth would all begin the day after the close and run for 2 weeks.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I appreciate you thinking about the kiddos with these expanded days for them. But let me ask you this. If we're thinking about the kiddos and you're talking about after school, well, it's not really much hunting time where a dad can get off and, or a mom can get off work and take them to the field to hunt. We have certain special deer seasons in the month of October. In fact, one of our two youth hunt days, which is preposterous, we only have 2 days in the season. Why could not these Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday days be placed on the Friday, Saturday, Sunday of the month of October? And if you want to add it to January, then make it Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in those 2 weeks of January. To me, I believe that would make more sense and offer more youth money accompanied by a parent than picking these Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday days in there where you know the kids are not going to be taken out of school on those days to go deer hunting. And there are a few schools in East Texas that still close on the first day of deer season, a tradition. I'll argue for that.
But let me make sure I understand, though. You would suggest all weekends in October plus the Fridays would be youth seasons?
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So if they get out there to the deer camp or where they're going to go deer hunting, start on Friday evening, Saturday, and then Sunday morning, too.
We could certainly look at that. I know that several years back we had a proposal that was very similar. I don't recall the years, but in one period we had every weekend in October and every weekend in January was the proposal for youth deer seasons. And roughly speaking, there was a lot of opposition. The only opposition that came, and it came primarily from the archery community, was
was for the youth weekends on in October. There didn't seem to be a problem with January, so I don't recall exactly why, but for whatever reason the commission at that time chose to not adopt or withdraw that proposal. But obviously it's at the discretion of this commission to tell us what you'd like to see.
I wasn't on the commission then, that was before my commission time, but I clearly remember that. And the muzzle people with this, they've had fit. But in my way of thinking, I believe it is more important for us to take care of those youth hunters and get them into the field than it is to take care of a special group of people who want to hunt with a special gun. That's a slam dunk.
John, what your concern is it appears that we're adding a lot of incremental opportunity, but we're really only adding one weekend.
That's right.
And in October, you'd like to add every weekend.
Sure. Yes.
And thoughts on that?
Oh, well, as far as resource concern, there's not a resource concern with that. We'll definitely take any feedback we get from you and put together a proposal, as far as it relates to youth seasons.
Let's talk about in October, under managed land plans, of course, you can start hunting October 1st.
That's correct.
Bow hunting starts October 1st, so the season's open in a lot of ways for a lot of different groups already. Let's just talk about
except for kids.
Yeah, that's what I'm leading to.
And why should
we? What you're saying is then we should have youth hunts on the weekends.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Friday, Saturday, Sundays for every weekend in October. Along with that, the others.
Sure. Departmentally, we're already here.
And departmentally, you're already in the hunting season for a lot of people anyway, in some form or fashion. Okay. January, help me again, just without telling kind of off, what would you like to do in January?
Those two after season weekends.
Right. Friday, Saturday, yeah.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Right.
Okay. Your initial reaction, Clayton, in January, you look at not having the weekdays and just the weekends,
We're willing to go with either of those. Like I said, it's not a resource issue. If we want to, if we want to exclude Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we can do that. I'm just looking for some direction here. It sounds like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday is the direction we want to look at. If you like my proposal to exclude those other weekdays, we can do that.
In January, of course, the season has ended, let's say this January, has ended on the 4th.
That's when it will end this year, yes, sir.
Well, if you're managed land plan now, though, you can still be hunting.
Till the end of February.
Still be open, muzzle loaders, still be hunting.
If the proposal we presented to you goes forward and is adopted, then muzzleloader would run through the 18th.
So that would still be open and
on
too. So you could just run it all the way through. In other words, not just the weekend, but just run the youth all the way through, just
correct,
like you have it here. Okay, and we'd give you add two more weekends and during the week. Because we're thinking about shutting the hunting camp down and trying to reopen it type of thing relative to the youth hunts, which you've already, you have a lot of those already be open and would stay open.
Okay.
That can make sense.
Yeah, take a look at keeping October and January consistent, and maybe that's too many days.
Say that louder.
Just for consistency, I think keeping October and January consistent would be helpful, I think, just for people to remember what.
Yeah.
Unless you see a resource issue as you go through and look at this.
Part of this proposal, you may remember, is provide some consistency in January with respect to the late antlerless and spike season, the muzzleloader season, and the youth-only season, so that they're running concurrently and ending the same time. And I think that's kind of cleaned up, simplified somewhat with a consistent ending date. So now, just so you know, that was some of the logic behind that. And also with that,
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, even in January, it would still end the 18th.
Yeah, but that, but given the whole week, I mean, in other words, it doesn't have to be Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's run all the way to the 18th.
That'd be high.
Yeah.
The more the kids, the better.
Yeah.
The January part of this looks good then, as is.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
And now, and as far as October goes, are we looking at, for instance, if that were this year, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 10th, 11th, and 12th, 17th, 18th, 19th?
And 24, 25, 26.
That adds a lot. The only thing, so January looked the same except for the last weekend would be added potentially, or we look at adding that whole weekend?
No, because what ends on the 18th? Why are you ending on the 18th in January?
Well, my muzzleloader and our late antler spike seasons.
That's when they
end. And everywhere except South Texas would all end then, so it would, we think it, at least as far as keeping up with that.
It's just
that adds effectively two total weekends if we amend it, as suggested, which is also good for six weekend days.
In October, do have all your weekends be Yukon weekends, potentially?
Okay. I think we're clear on that.
Commissioner Guy Carter.
That's the way I would like to see it. You.
Sure.
That's
all right. I agree. We're trying to encourage you, honey. No doubt about it.
On the last weekend in October, then, it would not include, if you did, you would include the 31st, 1st, and 2nd of November. It would end, it would just be the
12th. The 1st of November. November is the opening deer season, and they've already got 31
right.
In.
They're just running
red.
Right. Okay.
So we that last week would we just would we run that straight through?
Well, here's the argument. Yeah, in October, should you just make October? all month, Yukon month. What difference does it make?
But from a resource standpoint, I mean, when we look at a big game harvest survey and I look at the harvest data, you can see that
right.
Kids are getting out there. You can detect that. But from a resource standpoint, as long as our county bag limits are the same, our answer on that end is it's going to get more kids hunting and it's not going to have an impact. We would tell you that,
you think the archers will have a problem with that?
Oh, no, I'm just saying it's a good idea.
Just to open all month?
Simplify the process.
Just simplify the process. In other words, the month of October becomes you find along with a bow.
Well, I was going to follow up on Robert's observation. I think that archers may have an issue with it for the same reasons that we see the tension and grazing. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just suggesting there likely to be some negative.
But you know, I'm sure, Fisher Duggan, that there will be some argument there. But what are we trying to promote for the future of hunting in Texas? Where is that increase going to come from? It's not going to come from specialty hunting groups. It's going to come from the population. As the population comes to age 21 or wherever it is, they can buy their hunting license, go hunting by themselves. And that is the resource that we have to direct ourselves to.
I don't disagree. You won't get some argument. Remember, we are going to go to public hearings on this. This is just to get the conversation started. I like the idea of making all of October youth along with Bo and other versus just the weekends alone. And let's see what kind of response we get in our public hearings. Let's see where they are. The Bo hunters are fairly well organized. We're very quickly back one way or another.
Someone wiser than me passed me a note and reminded me about youth turkey also, which is not my program, but I would suspect that we would look
at that this afternoon. We end up to coordinate all of that, getting way beyond my capability.
Okay, we will take that all of October and what we see on January, and it's my understanding when we propose the most liberal package that offers us some opportunity to back off of that, the commission does, as opposed to the flip side. And I will proceed. I do have a few more items here. area of harvest on forest, the United States Forest Service and some of these other public lands basically need to be restricted to some degree because in many cases these properties have open access. Our regulations are kind of a hodgepodge, and so we're just trying to clean, we would propose to clean this up a little bit and have the standard language be analyzed by permit only. There would be a couple of exceptions. One exception in Fannin County, where no analyst permit would be required because of other types of control mechanisms, and an exception for Wise and Montague counties, where staff would like to propose 4 doe days on Forest Service land. Additionally, last year, after we were well into the process, we got a request to look at Palmer County as far as the mule deer season. We do our mule deer surveys in January, and so we anticipate we will come back in January with some kind of a proposed season for Palmer County if we end up finding some mule deer in Palmer County. And our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee and staff have been working diligently for over a year on a bunch of different issues related to wasted game and tagging. Boyd Kennedy, our staff attorney, has been drafting the legislation. Most of these changes that we would like to recommend would require statutory changes, but he did discover last week that this commission may have some authority to amend tagging requirements when it comes to when tagging requirements cease. And so in January, we anticipate coming back with a proposed rule that would better define when tagging requirements cease. And now to Grayson County. Most of you are probably aware that we received a petition for rulemaking earlier this year to open a firearm season in Grayson County. Grayson County is the only county in the state of Texas where during what is normally the general firearm season, the take of deer, whitetail deer, is restricted to archery equipment only. We received a petition for rulemaking, and the petitioner basically made the argument that Grayson County looks like some of the other counties around there, the deer herd should look the same, and therefore Grayson County has the capacity to sustain a gun season just like the other counties. And there's some merit to what the petitioner is arguing. This is a close-up of Grayson County, and you'll see these are the two resource management units that Mitch was referring to. And they're in the north end of the county up against Lake Texoma. That's where the Hagerman National Wildlife Refuge is. It's kind of an epicenter for bow hunters. It's well known, and some of the hunting also takes place on private land up there. But most of the deer habitat in Grayson County is up in that gray area, that RU-22. But what the petitioner argues is Denton and Cook County, just to the west there, they look the same, and they've had a gun season for many years, and that is true. That country just to the west of there, the habitat type's the same. It's in the same RMU classification, and there has been a gun season there for many years. So answering that question, could Grayson County sustain a gun season? The answer is yes. Now, however, there is a unique
say that you're talking about from a biological or scientific
standpoint. Now, we've received a lot of opposition to that. Honest answer. And to be honest with you, when we received the petition for rulemaking, our staff told us, they said, look, this is going to be very unpopular. We, all the fine people in Grayson County, we're going to make many of them mad by proposing a gun season. We've heard from many of them. But the honest answer is that if a gun season were open in Grayson County under the current regulations, then Grayson County could sustain it. But we do understand that there's some concern because Grayson County, albeit the data is very limited, it's intuitive that because harvesters are restricted to bow only, that the age structure of bucks in this country would be different. You look in Denton, Cook County, it's very fragmented habitat as it is in Grayson County. There's a lot of people competing for very few deer. So the deer herd, the buck segment, there's a lot of pressure on young bucks. You get in Grayson County, and all the data would indicate that the age structure is better. And so that is what we feel folks are wanting to protect, obviously, is that older age structure. So although the petitioner says it could sustain it, the deer herd does look different in Grayson County because the take of deer is by bow only. We were able to contact Mr. Cantu, who is the acting director on the Hagerman, because if we figured there may be a data set up there that's better than any data set we have, and just to look at age structure. Because the one thing that maybe we haven't been good in conveying to folks is that we would not propose, if you remember the RMU maps, we have antler restrictions proposed all across that part of the state. So the difference is, the paradigm shift is, if we were to propose a gun season in Grayson County, it would not be like the current gun season in Denton and Cook County, where every buck was legal. What we would propose is antler restrictions. So we received the data from Rick Cantu there on the Hagerman. Just we wanted to look at our antler restriction data from our six counties and compare it to the data on the Hagerman. On the chart before you, the light-colored bars on the left for each age class, that represents the percentage of each age class in our six original counties. And you can see that, you know, 20 to 30% of the harvest is 1 and 2 year olds, and then in those six counties, the bulk of the harvest is 3 and 4 year olds. On the Hagerman, it's a little bit different, and this is restricted to bow only, in that in some years, or many years, 2.5 year olds make up the one age class with most of the harvest, but they do kill 3 and 4 year old deer. They have, and probably if you went into Cook and Denton County, you would not see that. And that's what they're wanting to protect, is that older age class. But we would suggest to you with the data we have is that to the argument that a gun season would destroy or decimate the deer herd or the deer population, the data we have would indicate that that's not the case. And there is some indication that actually that more bucks would be put into the older age class because these two-year-old bucks would not be legal for harvest.
Sorry to interrupt, but you mean that by county in totality for the county, or could it potentially compromise this, you know, different habitat, especially managed areas?
As Mitch indicated, we, for Grayson County and for the buck segment, using our RMU concept, since the north part of the county is where the deer habitat is, we would choose the RMU 22 package, but it would apply to the whole county. So it would be for the whole county. Now, on the antlerless end of part of the bag limit, what we suggest to stay consistent with RMU 21, Ellis County, for instance, is RMU 21, that's permit only. What staff would propose is if you chose to propose a gun season, and if we're adopted, that we would propose antlerless by permit only, as opposed to the 4 doe days that are currently there in Grayson County. Now, I'll say that we have received
the 4 doe days, whether they're there now.
Yes, sir.
Are bow only?
They're bow only. Yes, sir. Now, I will say, as most of you are probably aware, we've received a lot of comments, and here recently we did receive a letter from Representative Larry Phillips. That's his district up there in Grayson County. And Representative Phillips asked that I read this letter into the record, so if you don't mind, I'm going to do that. It reads, "Dear Mr. Smith, thank you for visiting with me recently about maintaining archery-only deer hunting in Grayson County, as we discussed, and I would request that the department leave the current regulations regarding deer hunting in place. The current archery-only regulations have wide support within the community and among local government officials. I've attached a copy of a resolution on this matter from the Grayson County Commissioner's Court and a letter from our local district attorney, Joe Brown. I attended the county commissioner's meeting during which the resolution was passed, and the primary concern of the commissioners was the safety of the public should the hunting restrictions be lifted. They also recognize that Grayson County has been able to maintain a healthy and sustainable deer population via these restrictions, which could be threatened should these restrictions be lifted. I share both of these concerns and request that you convey these concerns to the chairman and the commissioners of Texas Parks and Wildlife. It is my hope that this issue is not further pursued by the department. Again, I appreciate your time on this matter. Please contact me if you have any questions or require additional information. Best regards, Larry Phillips." And then here recently, a letter that we weren't asked to read the record, but we also received a letter from Senator Estes here recently requesting that we be more careful about this. There is a common theme. Senator Estes doesn't talk about the concern about a gun season having an impact on the population, but he does reference safety, as did Representative Phillips. my information and talking with Ann Bright is that this commission does not have the authority to adopt seasons and bag limits and means and methods based upon safety concerns. And this issue has come up before, and we've received an AG's opinion on that. But if you want any further clarification, I think I would defer that to Ann Bright, somebody with a little bit of expertise there. I believe that concludes my presentation, so I'll be happy to take any questions.
Clayton, is there viable support for expansion currently in that county, or is it mostly the other way?
Expansion.
You know,
guns. No, sir. Most of the comments, the majority, the vast majority of comments that we receive here at Parks and Wildlife, to include petitions with numerous signatures, oppose the gun season, or a gun season.
Did you consider the possibility of allowing rifle hunting on MLD permitted lands only?
If I am not mistaken, I may be, but I believe that the county regulation on that trumps it. And if I'm wrong, if maybe Ann or Robert, someone might tap me on the shoulder. But we've had this question come up before, and I believe MLDP cooperators in Grayson County right now are restricted to archery equipment. So if we were to look at that, we probably would look at that in conjunction with Commissioner Brown's suggestion. In just reviewing our MLDP regulations.
Well, that could be a way of expanding it to the MLDP program.
So what's driving this is we have petitioners that's asking that be opened up to rifle hunting some level. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Obviously, this is the only county in the state that is bow hunting only at this point.
That's correct.
All we are again doing is looking at this to see what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. And you know, from staff perspective, you know, our first duty is to just look at what we believe will happen to the deer herd and respond to those comments. And as I said, we think that maybe there's we need to do a better job of explaining the impact of antler restrictions. Because we do not think that we would see a deterioration of the age structure, but that would only address those individuals that are concerned about the age structure. I mean, obviously, Grayson County is unique in that it's archery only, and so there may be other folks. And as I indicated, from a safety standpoint, it's my understanding this commission doesn't have the authority to adopt these seasons, bag limits, means, and methods based upon safety concerns.
Right, and so then. The issue that we have as a commission, though, of course, are other issues, political and otherwise. So at least as chairman, and this is open for conversation, I'd like to throw it out there that we look at it. We do public hearings. Okay, we've already obviously gotten a response from the county commissioners, from the representatives up there. Let's hear from some of the citizens, and then we can make some decisions in the next round.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Certainly, I have no bias one way or the other. They've had quite a history up there and a very wonderful tradition. Staying with it may be the right thing, but I would like to go through at least one more round of the process.
And I would like to say, our staff has been, they in no way want to antagonize anyone or all the fine folks in Grayson County.
We have enough. We create enough. I think the way the process works overall and the great job that you all do is that this should be part of the process. And then as we go through public hearings and do those kinds of things, obviously we were already getting very strong pushback about wanting to keep it though.
Yes,
and we certainly can vote and leave it that way.
Let's clarify something in my mind,
Chairman.
Are we going to say that we are going to include this county in our gun program for hunting deer? And if you want to come say something about it, you're welcome to come say something about it. Or are we going to say to the public that we have received this request, and we want to hear from all of the people before we make a decision.
Settle
the latter.
Latter.
The latter. Yes.
Okay.
And that we will present at the public hearings and other things the straightforward, you know, Buck Harvest age structure comparison, you know, the various counties around there, those kinds of things. As we've been told, we have no say on the safety side of it. We'll make sure we get that fed back to our local representatives and our state senator up there. That if they are against the debate, they may want to take another approach. You know, I want to work with our constituents up there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think that's a safe way for us to do it.
It's prudent. Yeah, I want to do it prudently, but I also want to stay with the process that Texas Parks and Wildlife uses and has used and has proven year after year after year, is that we go through the process. Okay? And at the end of the day, normally, if you use the process correctly, the right decision comes out. And we certainly want to honor the local constituency in Grayson County. I've got no issue. Let's do it the right way.
Right.
Could I just seek clarification on the record that we would include a gun season in the proposal that we'd come to you with in January, and then that would go to the Texas Register, and then we would conduct our public hearings, and we would have one in Sherman. And then, are we talking about some kind of scoping process in advance of the January meeting?
Yeah, I think that's the real question, Chairman. If you want to give us direction to have a formal public hearing in Grayson County between now and the January meeting, because I do want to be clear, is we've done exactly what Commissioner Parker has suggested. Okay. When we got the petition, and this is not a well-kept secret in Grayson County. So, I mean, we've gotten a lot of feedback,
yeah.
And we have made it, you know, abundantly clear.
Yeah, so then let's do a scoping, is that the term you're using?
Uh-huh, a scoping meeting.
Yeah, let's do a meeting specifically about this, so that people, and make sure they get plenty of notice, and there's plenty of opportunity. And I would definitely like, of course, the county commissioners, obviously any interested constituents, let them know way ahead of time, but also any of the elected officials up there, whether it be our state representative or our state senator.
Is it an all or nothing proposition, or can this process allow for other suggestions, such as a muzzle loader only or a limited 1 week season? I'm just saying, I'm asking that question. I'm not.
Well, my understanding is, of course, in January, when we go to the Texas Register, whatever we publish, if there are other alternatives out there, typically speaking, if they're all put out there on the table, then this commission has the authority to not necessarily adopt all, as long as the public has had an opportunity to comment. So when we do these scoping meetings before January, when we come forward, then we'll have an agenda item. But the simple fact of the matter is our latitude is where we have the greatest latitude is if we propose a season that we can then, that this commission can choose to say, no, don't do that. And because I suspect when we go to Grayson County, the meetings will be well attended. I do not think that a gun season is going to be popular. I don't know about these other opportunities or MLD opportunities, but if that's the case and if our predictions hold true and it's not popular, the question would then be when we come forward to you in January, we'd probably just lay it out there and then seek guidance from you and then decide what we're going to go to the Texas Register with.
I guess, Clayton, I think what I hear from Mr. Duggan's question is, though, if between now and the January Commission meeting, someone comes forward with a different idea, yeah, one that has not been considered, but one that, which potentially has merit, could that be considered by the commission in January and then given us direction to go forward with additional public comment through publication of the Texas Register? Is that what you're saying, Commissioner?
Yes, but I'd also like to invite the people up there to weigh in and make suggestions if they have them for alternatives if this one is so unpalatable, which it evidently is.
That could be discussed in these public hearings?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and is there a way to reach out and do that through what, through the...
We could use the local press, no doubt, and our media folks to get the word out, and I'm sure the county commissioners and everyone would, and the local press up there would help us get the word out and just get as many folks, and we can just put together a laundry list of suggestions to bring to you.
Yeah, and then we can choose to say yes or no or whatever, okay.
Yes, sir.
I like that. Okay.
Is this whole process emanating from one person's request, or is there a group of people that want to change this?
The process was initiated by this petition. Now, I have to be honest with you, we received the petition just prior to our regulations process, so I can't say that when our staff got together and used this RMU concept, and we looked at those RMUs, Grayson County is going to stick out like a sore thumb. And we, staff, would have a hard time coming up with a biological justification for that. So, but nonetheless, I guess the petitioner brought this forward before. If you read the blogs, archery blogs, and some of the responses to articles, there are some people out there that suggest that a gun season is appropriate, and that resource should be available to gun hunters and bow hunters, but they definitely are in the minority.
Well, I think the public hearing process will certainly answer, if there is a groundswell, it will come forward at that time. But it just seems to me this is all coming from a very, very small group of people.
You mean the gun part?
It is.
Ben, do we have to, in this process of hearing the people out, I mean, the letters that I've been getting have been overwhelmingly against having a gun season. And, I hate to agitate anybody more when they've already spoken so loudly. So whatever process we do, I don't think we should go out there and create more problems for ourselves. If there's going to be a hearing, do we have to have a hearing saying that we're going to change the rules? Or can we just have a hearing saying we want to hear more from the local community?
My understanding is the latter. Is that...
Okay.
We can do that. We routinely have scoping meetings if our staff is thinking about something before we come to you, just to kind of get the pulse. So we're not restricted to doing that after it's published. We can go up there and ask folks' opinions ahead of time.
The other thing is that I'd like to hear more about the safety issue. That we shouldn't make any decisions based on safety, but we don't license people unless they have a safety course.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard that. Sounds like we are in the safety business.
Yes, we are.
One or nothing. Maybe hand brake can help at the end of the run.
For the record, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. On safety, there are some provisions in the Parks and Wildlife Code where the Commission does have some authority. For example, there's water safety. Individuals under a certain age have to have attended some sort of hunter safety program. However, that's pretty much the extent of it. Seasons and bag limits are based on actually several factors, and that's it. This came up, I don't know if any of you were on the commission back when there was the issue about hunting in riverbeds. That was a safety, the sole concern was a safety issue, not a biological issue. And so while there's some safety authority when it comes to setting seasons and bag limits, it's really based on biology.
Okay, so it's just the way the regs using the right term.
And there are a couple of AG opinions, they're fairly old, like in the early 70s, but that make clear that the authority does not extend to human safety.
So the AG opinion actually says that?
Yes, sir.
They don't want you getting up there and getting involved in highway patrolman.
Right. So you go through a safety issue, you have to say that it's because of more against the biological presentation.
There are a number of factors.
That big deer.
What would be the difference in the safety with that county and the rest of the counties?
Well, the safety argument has been brought up numerous times, and the fact of the matter is there's a lot of country in Texas that looks like Grayson County. It's right, you know, right on the edge of Dallas-Fort Worth. It can be right down the road here in Williamson or Travis County, where it's highly fragmented. You know, there are, I believe it was two sessions ago, there was a statute that the legislature adopted that made it illegal to shoot across a property line. So the legislature has, you know, taken some action dealing with firearms discharge, and not necessarily for hunting purposes, I don't think, but there are some statutes out there that make it illegal to shoot across a property line. But there's a lot of Texas that is highly fragmented, highly developed, and is still hunting with firearms.
If I could make one more comment about that too, which is that how this is normally handled is that municipalities do have authority to prohibit the discharge of a firearm within the city limits. And counties have authority to enact a similar prohibition in a subdivided area. So that's, in other words, they have a little bit more authority with safety, and that's where a lot of these regulations, safety type regulations come in.
But counties have no zoning authority. They can't really limit an unincorporated, unsubdivided area.
That's correct. And the other thing is, obviously, a landowner can always prohibit discharge of firearms on their property.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay.
Robin Rikers. My name is Robin Rikers of the Coastal Fisheries Division, and I'll be here to present to you the 2009-2010 Coastal Fisheries Scoping Proposals for the Statewide Hunting and Fishing Proclamation. Our three scoping issues are going to center around flounder regulations, consistency with federal regulations regarding snapper and some of the grouper species, not including red snapper, and also sharks. And then also we would like to scope an item which we is a paddle craft guide endorsement or new type of license, and we'll explain some of the reasoning for that today. Just to briefly catch you up on the southern flounder issue from the presentation that I gave to you in August in Houston, this one slide basically depicts the whole picture. These are our spring and fall gillnet catch rates. Our fishery independent monitoring program, or part of our fishery independent monitoring program, you can certainly see the long-term downward trend since 84, 86, and as you remember, bait trawls, our other fishery independent gear also showed this, as well as our bag seines, and in fact, even our fishery dependent catch statistics from both the commercial and recreational fisheries indicated this downward trend. So with that, we of course presented that to you in August, and then we went on to schedule some of our work group meetings. We scheduled both the recreational and the commercial work group. These meetings were actually scheduled for the week that Hurricane Ike came inshore, and so we canceled those, and we moved those to October 22nd and 23rd in Port Lavaca. And then beginning next week and the following 2 weeks, we will have additional scoping meetings where we've invited anyone who had a commercial finfish license and also anyone who is recreationally involved in the fishery that we could identify and reach out to.
Where will those be?
Those are in Port Arthur, Dickinson, and Port Lavaca, Rockport, and Port Isabel. And the dates on those are on the slide there. Next 2 weeks. In addition to that, just so that you know, prior to your January commission meeting, we will have additional scoping that will include flounder, but also these other items. Let me just kind of briefly catch you up on what happened at those first two scoping meetings in regards to our various management tools that we really have to use in addressing this issue. Certainly, we considered a decrease in the overall bag limit, and there was mixed review of that. The commercial folks on their work group feel like they're at about a bag limit of 60, which is kind of a minimum point for them to meet the efficiency requirements that they need in order to continue to harvest fish. Recreational folks were more inclined to decrease the bag limit, and they were suggesting decreases in bag limits from 10 to 5 fish on their bag limit, and for the commercials from 60 to 30, basically cutting the bag limits in half. When we looked at increased minimum size limits, there wasn't a lot of support for any sort of increase in the minimum size limit, and the reason for that, simply put, is a gig fish doesn't have a lot of opportunity to live afterwards. So, and not to mention the difficulty in telling the length of a fish when you have such a large portion of your fishery that is prosecuted with the gig fishery. Additionally, we looked at and discussed area closures, which would be closures around the passes where that escapement occurs. Not really a lot of favor for that. Certainly, there's not a lot of favor from our perspective as well due to the difficulty in law enforcement, and that's the reason there's not a lot of it in favor of that. Trying to delineate a line, trying to enforce that line around the pass is a difficult task at best, and certainly in a nighttime fishery like that. Lastly, and this is the point that we're certainly excited about at this point, when we consider time closures, we consider those closures in October, November, and December. I will say that both groups certainly understand that to have an impact in this fishery and to reach the escapement goals that we're trying to talk about here, I think everyone is in recognition that that's where you're going to have your action, is through some sort of protection during that October, November, and December run. Lastly, of course, the quotas and the IFQs, really, because they won't guarantee that escapement protection, they weren't really, we didn't discuss those a lot at all in this particular case. So if I had to summarize those meetings, you know, they went very well. We will have some, bring in some additional, broader set of folks in those next five meetings, and we hope to come back to you with a proposal that will have some consensus built around it in January.
Yes.
Question. As far as the entire coast, are we seeing the same percentage decreases throughout the whole coastal region? And do we have information for each region?
We do have that regional information, and we have looked at that. While some bay systems might have had a slight uptick, if you will, still the overall trend along the coast and within those systems is they are not where they were historically. So we believe it's a problem that is prevalent from Sabine all the way to Port Isabel. You know, we think that kind of wound management action is warranted and not a regionalization approach at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
To carry forward on Commissioner Brown's question, could we, you know, would you go back and look at that graph of your ill debt rates? You know, there is absolutely no argument other than we need to do something and do it quick. And it might be severe on some people. But if you look back at the redfish problem that we have, and that was severe, our actions were severe then on certain groups of people, but it had to be done to save the redfish in the bays from the Sabine to the Rio Grande. And as a senior citizen of this group, and I remember well the redfish war,
we're not going to contest you on that.
but you know, when Chairman Vance looked at that, at that graph, and it was very, very similar to the graph that we're looking here on flounder, he said, "Guys, we got to do something. And if it means upsetting some people down there, we got to do it." And you know, then Gory, talking about the commercial side of this, you know, you can put a size on it, but like you say, a gig flounder is a dead flounder. And you know, I really, really, really think that we need to take some drastic steps and with your recommendations. And I think we have to bow our back and our neck too and get this resource under our control, not under the control of commercial fishermen, but under the control that will best serve all of the people that use that category of resource.
Well, and let me just follow up again with that, Commissioner Parker. Certainly in that rec work group and the commercial work group we're working with, now certainly I think everyone would prefer not to do anything, but as I indicated, everyone did seem to recognize the need to take an action and a fairly severe action. And one of the proposals we talked about was a removal of the gig fishery, both rec and commercial, in October, November, and December. One of them was just the removal in November. And that those kinds of removals will bring you an increase in spawning stock biomass of somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 100%. So, you know, we're talking about severe reaction or a severe cut that will create a needed increase that, like you're referring to. And, you know, we're not even through with that conversation. There was the additional conversation of bag limit reductions. There's additional conversation regarding some of the shrimp trawl catch associated with flounder. So, you know, I agree with you. We want to make sure we come back with a proposal that is significant enough to try to turn this downward trend around.
But, you know, if you are setting your sights on increasing those numbers by 20%, you're still below, drastically below, your 0.02, 0.04 numbers. Even if you raise that by 20%, you'd still be in the hole.
The changes that we were talking about that I just mentioned were in the range of more like 50 to 100% increases. So I don't think we're looking for something at 20%. We're looking for a more significant impact than that, at least given the current conversation.
To go back and now formulate a proposal for January.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. And you remain of the opinion that no emergency measures are justified?
We believe that, yes, that's correct. We still believe that we can handle this in the current regulatory framework, and because we did have, as you can see on that graph, a very good recruit class in OA, and we believe we can do it with our current management structures, as well as the reality of the Upper Coast area right now. In many instances, it's probably going to be like we had a regulation in place this year from Galveston to Sabine, given the nature of the ice recovery up there. A lot of folks probably aren't going to be taking advantage of fishing opportunities. They're going to be doing other things at this point in time. So, you know, we've got, it's an unfortunate benefit, but we may end up with a kind of a regulatory benefit this year from that storm as well.
Robert, do you have a crew accounts, any crew accounts, surveys from the commercials?
Yes, sir. We have our trip ticket program, which basically captures the amount of catch that each individual brings in.
Hopefully we'll see all that as part of the data presentation.
Yes, I mean, when we basically get a proposal, we will bring as much of that as we need to help justify those proposals, certainly.
Good,
certainly. And in some of the range of what we're talking about here, when you talk about that 30 fish bag limit reduction, we've already taken a look at that. On average, the average catch is around 37 fish on those commercial landings right now. 30 to 60%, one year it was 30, the next year it's been 60% because of that recruit class have in fact landed over 30 fish at this point in time. So, you know, we're trying to see what the impact of those kinds of reductions will look like.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, okay.
Okay. Now, moving on to federal regulation consistency, as many of you remember, we basically brought the National Marine Fisheries Service Highly Migratory Species Plan, which was Amendment 2, to you last year in scoping. We had thought it was going to be adopted in the fall of last year and finalized. As it turns out, it did not adopt. We pulled it off of our scoping items in January because it hadn't finalized, and it went to final adoption in July 24th of 2008. So within that context, we would like to propose to you a prohibited list that would match the federal prohibited list. That's a prohibited list of 20 species, and only two species that are really concerned to us in that particular list are duskies and sandbars. Duskies and sandbars do make up, they're part of the top 11 species that we get. Now, what I might say to that is, of those 11 species, Atlantic sharpnose, black-tipped sharks, and bonnet head make up 80% of all our catch. So these two species would be a relatively minor component to our catches. So they would move into, or at least we would suggest we mirror that prohibited list. In addition to that, we would make a modification of our minimum length limit to equal their 54-inch fork length limit, which would be about a 66, 65-inch total length limit for us to those species which are allowed, with the exception of we would not include in that list Atlantic sharpnose, bonnet head, and black tips. We would have those three species remain at the 24 inches. In addition to that, we would like to have the opportunity to scope our other reef fish and groupers that we have, three of the most important of which are on the slide there. We would like to include others as well. Again, this does not include red snapper, but of those on the list there, you see gray triggerfish, which is recently being increased to a minimum length limit of 12 inches, and we don't have any minimum length limit. You have greater amberjack, which has been increased from a 28-inch fork length limit to a 32-inch, and we currently have a 32-inch total length limit, so we would want to slide that up as well. And gag, which has a 22-inch minimum length, we don't have any minimum length on that, and we would like to scope increasing or matching that minimum size limit as well. In addition, given the recent discussion regarding scoping items, that kind of parlayed into my discussion regarding this aggregate bag limit discussion as well. There are a host of aggregate bag limits that the federal fisheries have in place right now. There's a reef fish aggregate bag limit, a snapper aggregate bag limit, and a grouper aggregate bag limit. And the snapper and grouper, some of them feed into the reef fish, and then there are exceptions, and it's very complicated. We would like to consider something like that, but it would have to make much more sense than we believe that current set. I mean, there's reasons why they've done it the way they've done it, but we hope we could bring you something simpler than that by working with some of our constituents and working with law enforcement to bring you a set of some sort of aggregate bag limits that would make more sense for us to be able to enforce it and for people to actually be able to understand it in a way that they can not jeopardize themselves out there. Lastly, we would like to, again, scope a paddlecraft guide endorsement. Just to catch you up on what this is about, currently anyone who fishes in salt water has to have the all-water guide license, which allows them to fish either in fresh or salt water as a guide. To get that license, they have to show proof of a U.S. Coast Guard operator of uninspected passenger vessel, which is commonly referred to as the six-pack license. In order to get that particular license, they have to show 360 days of sea time in a powerboat. The reality of it is, as kayaks and paddlecraft, canoes, etc., has increased in their use, we have some folks who basically just do their guide services out of paddlecraft of some sort. And so we believe we would like to look at if there is a way that we can continue with some sort of safety training and training that is more specific to those paddlecraft. We'd at least like to scope that out, because we don't believe the Coast Guard license, in fact, really deals with some of the special, unique safety issues that you have when you're in a paddlecraft. Obviously, you're much more likely to overturn that paddlecraft. Visibility for you is much lower out there as compared to someone in a powerboat. Other safety concerns, if you do go overboard, is probably somewhat different as well. So we would like to at least have a discussion with some of those people out there in this industry and see if we can come up with a different set of guidelines. The things that we're considering at this point would be our current TBWD boater safety requirement that we have in place, or our course that we have in place, CPR and some sort of first aid requirement. And then more importantly, those specifically dealing with paddle craft could include the American Canoe Association or the British Canoe Union. They both have different levels of training that we think would provide adequate training of this sort. They are both offered here in Texas, and in fact, this would actually be a cheaper alternative. Both the American Canoe Association and British Canoe Union, it's a little bit different in pricing, but we believe the price to get those kinds of certifications that we listed here would be around $500 as compared to that U.S. Coast Guard certification, which runs about $1,000. So we would like to have the opportunity to go discuss that with some folks, see if we can bring you back either an endorsement or a license that would deal with that issue. With that, that concludes my presentation for Coastal Fisheries, and do you have any answering other questions?
Why do we call this a six-pack?
That's a common term that's been out there. It's U.S. Coast Guard. Do you know what that dates back to?
It's
six to 15, is that correct?
Yeah,
something like that. And then they have to go to a different license if they're going to haul over 15.
Thank you.
I would like to ask one question, not Robin. Because we don't have it on the agenda for discussion, but I would like to ask the Conservation Committee for January to make an item available for discussion for clear vetting the fiasco of the dove experiment up in Brown County this past the last 2 days of August, and I would like the Conservation Committee to put that on the agenda for the January meeting so that we can have a total vetting of that. I think we owe the people an explanation of not only what happened, but how we are going to take care of that in the future.
Commissioner, let us bring something forward in January, and I think what Commissioner Parker is alluding to, just to make sure everybody understands, is the research we have underway on non-toxic shot in doves, and so we'll bring forward a presentation and briefing on the underpinnings behind that research, and in a discussion then about some of our communication plans on the importance of that research, and we can talk about it in January. Would that be okay?
That would be fine. I just, you know, we took a terrible hit in the press over that, and I just think that we owe it to the people to give a complete explanation to them.
Okay, so there's a briefing request for Regs or for Conservation?
We can put it in a way. We can do Regs or Conservation. I'll talk to Scott, and we'll make sure. But we'll have it on one of the committees, right, and we'll make sure we bring forward a briefing and discussion.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Taking away on it.
You guys in Regs. Take all our time.
Yeah.
Right.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski. I'm the Inland Fisheries Regulations Coordinator, and today I'm going to go over our potential regulation changes for the upcoming license year. Just to briefly go over our process for these are a result of ongoing studies by our district staff and our research staff. Proposals are made earlier in the year. Undergo review at the district level and the regional level, and then we also typically in August we have a statewide meeting of all our biologists where we go over any potential regulation changes, discuss those, decide which ones we want to proceed with. Then we also present these before our Freshwater Advisory Board, and the proposals that we're still considering are the ones I'm going to present to you today. First one is on Lakeway Roberts, which is up to almost 26,000 acre impoundment on the Trinity River. It's up near Denton. It's surrounded by two state park units, six small satellite parks that are on some of the access areas. There's also a WMA there, and it also serves as a sort of a trailhead from the Greenbelt corridor from Lake Ray Roberts down to Lake Louisville. Just to briefly go over the management history there, it was impounded in 86, officially opened in 1990, and the length limit we had on there for largemouth bass was an 18-inch minimum length limit with a 3-fish daily bag. When we did some consolidation of regulations, we increased that bag to 5. A big change that we did implement there was in 1998. We went to a 14 to 24-inch slot with a 5-fish daily bag and limiting the harvest to only 1 fish over 24 inches. Our goal there was to increase some of the trophy-sized bass in the population. There was a lot of interest there locally. They were producing some bigger fish, and there was the hope that this lake could develop into a lake that would hold some of those larger fish. Taking a look at what we've seen in that population since then, looking at the population structure, prior to that implementation of the regulation, those fish between 14 to 24 inches, and after that implementation, we really haven't seen any increase in those fish within the slot, which we were hoping to see there. The lake has produced a few shallow-anchor fish, but we really haven't seen any market change in the numbers there. So basically, we don't feel that the goals of that initial regulation change were achieving what we wanted to see there. What we're proposing to go to at this time is to return to a 14-inch minimum length limit, the statewide limit, and a 5-fish daily bag. We think that's looking at the population. It's better suited to the fish population and also the fishery with the state park, the large influence of the state park and the state park visitors. There's a lot of general anglers that come there just looking to fish a variety of fishing experiences. It does have a good bass population, and there's a lot of other good populations, white bass, channel catfish, crappie, so it's a good all-around fishing lake, and we think that regulation would be better suited to that. It also might have some positive economic impact. It might allow a few tournaments to come to that reservoir close to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and there might be some benefits there to local economies and to our parks. Some anglers may object to this increase in harvest and also to the potential for tournaments, but this is something we'll propose and see what type of input we get there in the local community. Next, you're talking about the next two proposals are concerning some fisheries and fishes we haven't typically dealt with in the past. Largemouth bass is one that we've dealt heavily in. The first one, we're talking a little bit about managing for quality catfishing. The blue catfish have drawn a lot of increased interest from anglers and biologists for its potential to produce large fish and trophy-sized fish. Some of you that were around a few years ago when Splash, the world record catfish, was caught out Lake Texoma, that just generated a tremendous amount of interest in the press and the local community, and when we had it there on display at the Freshwater Fishing Center, and that really highlights to us how many people out there are interested in these larger catfish. In a fisheries magazine, some researchers did some surveys of anglers looking at what are their opinions of some of the developing trophy catfish. 75% of them were strongly favored the development of those trophy cat fisheries, and 65% would be in favor of more stringent regulations if they had a better chance of catching a trophy. Additionally, 8 states have adopted some sort of trophy regulation, either on a statewide basis or a local population that has the characteristics that would support some trophy angling. So these are some of the things we've been considering for here in Texas. focusing on our blue cat fisheries. We have extensively stocked blue cats in addition to their being native to some of our reservoirs. Typically when we stock those reservoirs, fisheries are slow to develop, 10, 15 years before a large enough population develops to get a lot of good spawning and recruitment in the population and also to develop some of those larger sized individuals. What we're seeing in Texas and what other researchers have seen in Missouri and Oklahoma is that there's very high harvest of big blue cat fish, especially in winter months by jug line anglers, and seeing some very high exploitation of anglers targeting these larger fish, and that's something that if we want to maintain some quality fisheries that we feel we have to address. Some of the reservoirs that have characteristics of the population is the blue cat top populations that we want to look at. I'll go over that. Typically when we're investigating a new regulation, we like to look at a variety of reservoirs, just not go to one site. We try and go to multiple sites to try and learn as much as we can about how that regulation will perform in different populations. First one's Lake Waco in McLennan County. That's a lot of the initial ideas about regulating these blue cat has been developed by our staff up there. We're looking at two other reservoirs, Lake Louisville in Bend County and Richland Chambers. There's a couple other reservoirs that have some of those similar characteristics in their blue cat populations, good growth rates, some large individuals, and some interest there in the winter jug line fishery. The regulation that staff is looking at this time, that I think we can use to address some of those concerns in those populations is a 30 to 45 inch slot limit, maintaining the 25 fish daily bag, but only limiting the harvest to one fish over 45 inches, and that would be on blue catfish only. We still would want to maintain some harvest there. Harvest is an important part of catfishing, and that's something we certainly want to maintain there. Also, Oklahoma is considering a statewide limit for blue catfish, and we're going to discuss that with them as it may impact Lake Texoma. We meet on a regular basis with the whole Oklahoma fisheries people and try and keep the regulations on both sides of the reservoirs similar so it'll be easy for local enforcement and our anglers. I'm looking at some of the benefits and considerations here for managing for these quality trophy catfish. We're sort of interested in increasing those fish above 30 inches. We're also interested in having anglers increase the targeting of those big blue catfish. Allowing a one over would allow anglers to keep the trophy catfish if they did harvest one. Some of the concerns there, certainly will have some impacts on winter jug line. Jug line, maybe activity may decrease or anglers may object to that slot limit. We're hoping the benefits of maintaining some of those fish above 30 inches will counteract that. And long-lived, larger fish like this are difficult to evaluate, so our staff, along with our district staff, along with our research group, are going to closely evaluate these populations to see what the impacts of the populations will be by any regulations that we do possibly implement. Moving on to another species that has certainly increased in interest here in Texas is alligator gar. There's certainly been a lot of changes in attitude toward gar in recent years. It's long considered a trash fish that had negative impacts on populations. Back in the 80s, we did do a study of alligator gar in Sam Rayburn Reservoir. There were some concerns there about bass anglers, that they were impacting the bass populations. That's always a common perception that large fish like gar will have negative impacts on game fish. But what we found there is that typically the gar in that population were preying on other species other than bass. They certainly, being a top predator, they do take some game fish, mostly species like gizzard shad were comprised a lot of the diet of these fish. Now anglers are targeting targeting this fish for the large size, and even among those who are doing that, there's some advocacy for harvest limits. The fishery here in Texas is literally drawing people from all over the world to come and try and harvest some of these large alligator gar. State agencies around the country have recognized this unique fishery. Some of them have started to implement regulations to protect some of these gar populations. In some part of its range, the fish have been fairly decimated, both by harvest and habitat concerns have played a big part there, and some of those states are considering stocking to recover those populations. Looking at what we're proposing here in Texas and what we're hoping to accomplish, some of our goals there, we have a unique fishery for large fish in Texas, and we certainly want to sustain that trophy harvest. We want to ensure that those populations continue to be viable, and protecting some of those spawning size fish is very important here, and maintaining overall good population structure. And to attain these management goals, we will have to have reduced harvest to sustainable levels, and continue to investigate, ID, and protect those critical habitat areas that are very crucial to the health of the species. Some of the challenges here to our management, the populations are difficult to sample, especially in those large river systems. Our traditional gears that we use in reservoirs aren't really effective for gar in general and alligator gar in specific. We certainly have to consider the impacts of commercial fishing. We do issue some permits in fresh water to allow anglers to harvest some gar, so we'll have to certainly consider that. There's a general lack of information on all gar species, mainly tied to that difficulty of sampling in all types of environments. After my presentation here, we'll have Dr. Lee Solano come up and give some information on the status of gar around the country. She's one of the leading authorities and researchers on those species, and we've taken some of the information she has with information we've collected here to look at our populations all over the range to see what possible impacts we could have by management actions. We've also initiated some research projects here in Texas, some tagging studies in the Trinity River to look at those populations, get an idea of some population structure, also to try and look at what are the critical habitat areas, and also to look at some the genetics of those gar populations. One of the things that we looked at to try and get a little bit of an idea what some possible impacts of regulatory actions would be, we did some population modeling to look at these populations. There's a number of assumptions that we have to enter into these models. You can vary these assumptions in a lot of different ways to get different outcomes to the model, but just to give you an idea how some of those look under these certain conditions of low natural mortality. These are large, long-lived individuals. They become mature at a larger age. The fecundity or the ability to produce a lot of eggs is related to those larger-sized individuals. And just taking a look at this graph here, looking at a theoretical population of about 10,000 individuals, you can see with just an annual harvest of 10% over a 25 period, you're looking at the reduction in that population of over 50%. This is all somewhat theoretical, but it's not too hard to imagine some of our populations that are sustaining some harvest at that time have harvest at these levels. So this kind of gives us a cause for concern that we need to address these populations. Some of the management options that we've been discussed are our staff, led by Dave Buckmeyer, who's here with us today, have looked at a lot of various options for managing gar to see if we could attain our management goal. One of those would be a tag, issuing a tag to anglers, an on-demand tag that we would be able to go back later and possibly query anglers on their activities, get some more information on the populations. That could possibly even be limited to one fish per year and could have a minimum length limit. We could go with a length and bag limit. a minimum length limit limiting it to one per day. Some of the other options we considered were some of the other things, area closures, quotas, seasons, gear restrictions, and catch release, but we believe those, the first two options are the best ones that we can implement and would have an impact on our fishery at this time. So sort of what are our next steps here? As with all these regulation proposals, we're going to continue to evaluate the options, collect information, continue our research and our activities in this area, and if we decide to move on this, we will continue to collect your input and input from others and settle on an option before the January commission meeting. Those are all our options that we are considering for this year. You would have any questions or comments further on that? And I would also, once again, note that Dr. Farrar will follow me with some additional information on alligator gar.
Thanks, Ken. I'd like to ask Kirsten a question. I didn't realize.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any questions on the other two proposals?
Any other questions? Discussion? Thank you, Ken. Okay. For committee item number 8, status of alligator gar population.
Once again, my name is Ken Kozowski, the Inland Fisheries Division, and we have with us today Dr. Lee Ferraro, is an Associate Professor of Biological Science at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Dr. Ferraro did her PhD work at Auburn University on life history and strategies and gar management, and she's one of the continued her research there at Nicholls State University on gar populations. And she says that she's one of the leading authorities on gar in the U.S. and I'd like to have her give some information that she's gleaned over the years of her research.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to speak about one of my favorite fishes. Okay, alligator gar historically had ranged from about central Florida down through Mexico to Veracruz along the Gulf Coast. And then up into southern Ohio and southern Illinois, and then westward over to parts of Texas and Oklahoma. So it was a pretty large range that was covered by these fishes. But unfortunately, we've seen a dramatic contraction in the range of these fishes, not only in the U.S., but also in Mexico. Just recently, the fish has been listed as vulnerable by the American Fisheries Society Endangered Fishes Committee. And what this vulnerable designation means is that the species is in imminent danger of becoming threatened across its entire range or at least a significant portion of its range. In Oklahoma and Kentucky, alligator gar are currently listed as species of concern. And they've been extirpated from the northern portions of their range in Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio. Some of the reasons for this recent listing include the very long lifespan of these fishes. We believe that they can live somewhere between 50 and 75 years. And whenever you have an organism that has a very long lifespan like this, you're going to see a very low natural mortality rate. They also mature at a relatively old age and relatively large size. And they have very, very specific spawning habitat requirements. So they require flooded vegetation. And this can be areas like vegetated marshes that you may find in the more coastal areas, or in the interior portions in inland rivers specifically, you have to have that overbank seasonally flooded area, which in many parts of Texas doesn't happen every year. And again, they're restricted mostly to the eastern and central portions of the state. But in those inland rivers, these types of habitats that are needed may not be inundated every single year. So in some of these populations, you may have recruitment occurring very infrequently. So the current regulations in other states, and remember, the northern portions of the range in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, the fish has been extirpated. For the states that still have alligator gar populations, we see two that have no harvest in Tennessee and in Florida. In other states that still have at least so much semblance of alligator gar populations, we see bag limits. So we see them one per day in Alabama, two per day in Mississippi, two per day in Arkansas, and a new regulation that will be going in this January in Oklahoma, and one per day. Missouri's kind of out there a little bit with 50 per day, but at least they have a limit. In the western part of the Gulf, in Louisiana and Texas, we currently don't have any regulations. I guess that's why I'm here. In Louisiana, we don't have regulations either, and we do support pretty extensive commercial and recreational fisheries. But the recreational fishery in Louisiana is very different from the fishery here in Texas. We have large fish. We have 100 pounds, 150 pounds, 200 pound fish out there, but not in the numbers defined in Texas. So Texas definitely has a very, very unique fishery, and the goal of trying to promote a trophy fishery is pretty much only, Texas is the only place where this can happen now, because we see such a decline in the numbers and the size structure of the remaining population. So in Texas, there are some amazing fish. There are alligator gar that are 150, 200 pounds. There are 200 pound fish that are harvested every year or caught every year. So it's a place that anglers know about and are coming to in greater numbers to try to have the opportunity to catch these fishes. this is a image that is becoming more prevalent on Texas fishing websites. This is a picture from 2004, and you can see that these men harvested a large number of fishes, and we think that about half of them look to be reproductive sized females. So the word is out, and people know, so they come to Texas for the big alligator gar. In this figure, I've got two different populations. The red is Bayou Dewlarge from southeastern Louisiana. This is a coastal population. And there are about 328 fish collected. And the data on these fish were collected with the assistance of a commercial fisherman that we've worked with very closely for a couple of years. And the particular data that are shown here are going to be used by a master's student at Louisiana State University. We've also had many students in our lab doing various aspects of research on this particular population. The orange bars are data that's been collected from a guide on the Trinity River and Texas Parks and Wildlife personnel. So there's close to 300 fish there, and you can see that the size structure of the Louisiana population is definitely skewed towards smaller individuals. There's two other bars to notice on this graph. The blue bar is the size of maturity for males. You can see that both the Texas and Louisiana populations have a lot of reproductive size males. The pink bar is the size of maturity for female alligator gar. And you can see that in the Texas population in particular, there's a lot of large reproductive size females that are still in the population. For the Louisiana population, it doesn't look quite as good. The Louisiana fishery, again, is made up of both commercial and recreational anglers, and we see an overall much smaller size fish than we find in Texas, and we think a lot of that has to do with the pressure that these fishes are receiving from the commercial fishers. And this box here indicates the largest individuals. This would be the trophy-sized fish that are 150 to 200 pounds in size. And for Louisiana fishery, there's only one fish that we caught out of the more than 300 individuals that actually falls into this size category. We had one individual that was over 153 pounds, and then we dropped down to fishes that are just over 120 pounds. Now, if you look like the Texas population has, this is almost 5% of the population that is made up of these very, very large trophy individuals. And, you know, compare this to the Louisiana population, less than 1% of the population is of this size. Okay, so just comparing the Louisiana and Texas populations again, the fish in Texas, the average fish is about three times as heavy as the fish in Louisiana. So Texas definitely has longer and heavier fishes. Again, in Louisiana, we do have commercial fisheries, which we think is one of the main reasons that we have a smaller size structure. We also have a tremendous amount of habitat. So I don't want to say in Louisiana that we need to get rid of our commercial fisheries. I think that we actually have enough habitat to support commercial and recreational fisheries, but we don't have this tremendous trophy fishery that Texas has. We do have big fish out there, but not in the abundance you find in Texas. So in summary, alligator gar populations have declined throughout their range. And it looks like the western Gulf of Mexico is the area where we have the strongest populations in both Texas and Louisiana. The Texas population, again, is unique. There's monster fish out there. And we've got 150, 200-pound fish coming around, and the anglers want to catch those fish. So the current harvest rate is probably pretty high, so there needs to be some sort of regulation of the harvest rate so that we don't see a shift towards smaller, average-sized fish that we see in Louisiana. The probably most difficult portion of this is trying to identify these spawning and juvenile habitats. But if we don't identify those habitats and don't protect those habitats, putting in a harvest regulation really isn't going to do much good. As we see increased pressure on our water resources, we're going to see increased pressure on these types of habitats and potentially a decline or degradation of these habitats, which will result in lower recruitment rates. So there's a two-pronged approach that should be taken to try to preserve this population in Texas for trophy fishery. Reduce the harvest and also protect these types of habitats that are absolutely critical for spawning and for the development of the juvenile fishes. Pat, was there any questions?
Any questions?
Yes.
What is the impact if you take out 1,000 pounds of alligator gar from a particular area? What fish takes its place? What's the result of the change? I mean, isn't it still a trash fish?
I wouldn't call it a trash fish. In some areas where there has been heavy pressure on alligator gar, you see, but I think are the true trash fish or rough fish, things like carp become more common.
You better be glad the carp fish.
I know. but they have to play a critical role. I mean, thinking of them being a top predator in these types of environments. They're weeding out other species, they're weeding out other fishes. And, you know, I can't lie, I'm incredibly biased. But what Texas has that is so unique is just a tremendous size structure. And then now this desire to maintain that trophy fishery, nobody else can do that. Nobody else has the size structure that Texas has. So there are probably going to be some people that are going to be negatively impacted by this, but with the decision to go towards trophy fishery, I think if you can regulate the harvest and protect these critical habitats, it's going to work.
But if you do remove the gar, you don't see them replaced by catfish, for example, or bass, or do you know?
I have to say I don't know.
Thank you.
I'm going to point out that, you know, gar in all our systems, they are native. They are part of those ecosystems that have developed over time. So that, you know, those systems, they compensate when certain fishes decrease. And, you know, there's the other complement of native fishes, whether it be crayfishes or other game fishes, will fill in those, you know, niches of for the production for that whole system. It's really individual to a particular area how that happens.
Another question? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to come.
Okay. We got a 9. Trapping, transport, and triple T. Game animals and game birds will request permission to post the
T. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Alan Kane. I'm the district leader for the South Texas Wildlife District. And today I'm going to present a proposal for change in the application deadline for the trap, transport, and transplant permit, commonly referred to as a triple T. In get started with and give you a quick review of the current rules for the Triple T permit in regards to deadlines and some of the requirements. The complete application received by the department between September 1 and November 15th in a calendar year shall be approved or denied within 45 days of receipt. Applications may be received through March 31st, and white-tailed deer may be relocated between October 1st and March 31st. In addition, the Triple T application requires field approval of the release sites. Our wild management plan must be approved by field staff while the biologist is out there. In addition, on the application itself, it must be signed off on by field staff for trap and release sites, and an on-site habitat inspection must occur on those release sites. At issue, at least for field staff, is the majority of Triple T applications are received after January 1 in a permit year. For example, last year in 2007-2008, we had 77 permits issued. 51 of those were actually issued after February 1st. Now, 77 permits doesn't sound like a lot, but that represents 120 release sites across the state. In my district alone, South Texas, we had 86 individual release sites last year, so that's quite a few out there. As such, field biologists are constrained by late Triple T requests and necessity to complete habitat inspections. You know, folks come in February or March and say, hey, we want to get this permit. We're scrambling to try to get that done. In addition, that request, trying to fulfill those requests, we're having to sacrifice or put aside other arsenal programs, such as our technical guidance program, our managed lands deer permits program, which also require browse survey, same type of survey that the Triple T permit requires for the release site. And other job duties, whether it's regulatory surveys or whatever else we're called to do during those time periods. And for example, again, to put things in perspective, we've got 733 last year level 2 and 3 managed land deer permit cooperators. Those guys are also seeking our assistance as required by the permit itself to conduct on-site habitat inspections as well as these Triple T requests. And so we're trying to find a balancing act there. So we're proposing this rule change to Triple T regulations. And it states that all trap sites, release sites, number of deer to be trapped and released, be designated on the Triple T application, must be received by the department no later than January 1 of the current permit year. In summary, when you look at the research we'll be conducting on how to do habitat inspections in the best time of year, the winter sampling period is the best time, so it's a short time period to get this done, January, February there, parts of December. Both Triple T and MLD programs require habitat inspections, and the January 1st deadline would provide the biologists the flexibility and the planning to hopefully accomplish these Triple T requests coming in instead of being crunched late in the season and sacrificing other TPWD programs, whether it's managed lands deer permit or technical guidance. And it would allow us to maintain the integrity of those programs. And with that, staff requests permission to publish amendments as presented in the Texas Register for public comment. If y'all have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Does this change, do you still have the 45 days?
Yes, from September 1st to November 15th, we still have to respond within 45 days.
Okay.
And what we're asking is as of January 1st, that the applications must have the trap site, release site, all that has to be complete, and to department field staff, or departments, the department could come here by January 1st. We don't get requests after January 1st, but it wouldn't change. We'd still be able to approve or deny within that 45 days. Yes.
Well, that was my question. I wasn't clear whether we were sliding this thing forward or without the benefit of the spring falling crop.
We're keeping the first part, November or September 1st, November 15th still be intact. And we have to guarantee approval and denial of that permit within 45 days.
So if an application were to come in after the first of the year,
our field staff would probably do is say, look, you missed the deadline, let's get you set up on a management plan, let's find out what you need to do and get you on the process for next year. And try to work with them getting the program, but at that point, after January 1st, we're not going to accept any more applications and try to get them in, you know, completed surveys or whatever by that time. But, you know, we work with them, hopefully, get that through the next trapping season.
Any other questions? Discussion? No, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions. We have a session on authorized staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. And that concludes the regulations.
All right, complicated.
Well, I think if we just go ahead and convene finance, and we'll cover a couple of items. I know that we have some out-of-town partners, Mr. Heck and Pro Consulting, and after we finish the presentation, then we'll recess finance, we'll open up conservation, approve the minutes, and then we'll recess for executive session. So I'll coach you along the way. How's that? So,
I think I got it.
You got it? Okay, good. All right, I've got a lot of confidence in you.
I'm losing this football guy here. Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to make one public statement. I promised Commissioner Bevins that I would not bring up the fact that Texas Tech did defeat the University of Texas. So I'm not going to bring that up in this meeting.
There is a consensus of one that Texas Tech will go down.
The first order of business is the approval of minutes from the previous committee meeting, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
I move.
Got a motion by Commissioner Martin.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Falcone. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carried. Committee item number one is the update of on the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department progress in implementing the TPW Land and Water Resource Conservation and Recreation Plan, and Ms. Smith.
Chairman, just a couple things real quick. I just want to call everybody's attention to the report that the comptroller did on state parks. It was a great, great report highlighting the benefits of our state parks. Just want to make sure everybody has a chance to take a look at that. Everybody get that from the comptroller's office? Okay, good. It's a really, really good report.
Very good.
Okay, well, we'll make sure you have one. I guess in keeping with that, I just want to point out that last weekend, the intercommittee looking at the sporting goods portion of the sales tax met and had their first hearing, and they were given essentially two charges by the legislature in the last session to come back and make a recommendation of the legislature by December 15th on, one, the statutory definition of what should be included within the sporting goods portion of the sales tax, or what are those items that are included in part of that calculation. And then secondly, what should the recommended appropriation be to support the needs of our state parks, but also historic sites, and they're also looking at water planning and some coastal erosion needs. So it was a very productive hearing last week, and there's going to be some more work to be done by that committee, which is chaired by Representative Hildebrand and Senator Averitt. And so we'll talk more about that at another time, but I wanted to let you know that that process is underway. It is a critically, critically important one to the future of our parks fund. But Chairman, that's it for me.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. At this time, we will take item number six out of order. And item number six is the briefing on Parks Excellence Report required by the 2007 General Appropriations Act, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, right of 31. Mr. Scott Borough and Brian Trustee are going to make presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Commissioners and Mr. Smith, my name is Scott Borough, Deputy Executive Director, Operations. here today to give you a briefing on Rider 31, a little bit of context. As you will recall, at the end of last session, we were fortunate enough to get additional appropriation funding for state parks. As a condition, or at least as a requirement for that funding to be triggered, we were required to implement 48 auditor's recommendations and 5 riders. So from my perspective, we had a list of 53 to-do items. This presentation today will culminate to the end of the 50th one of those requirements being completed. It's an important one for us. This was a rider which in which the legislature asked us to look at what it would take to move into a system that was a high-quality state park system. We decided internally to pair this up with the Rider 30 exercise, which asked us to find an outside consultant to look at the impact of both improvement of facilities and major repairs on our visitation and revenues. So we have employed Fisher Heck, which is a very reputable architectural firm out of San Antonio, and Crowe's Consulting. Mr. Brian Trusky's up here with us today from Crowe's Consulting, which is an organization that for many years has worked with state park systems, the federal park system, and local park systems in terms of identifying issues that could improve those systems. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce Brian, and he's going to talk us through this.
Thank you, Scott. For the record, my name is Brian Trusky. I'm with Crowe's Consulting. It's my privilege to be in front of you again today to talk to you a little bit about the results of the Rider 31 study. Do we have the presentation that we can bring up here, or? Because it's out of the river, can I just kind of scan real quickly, or she can do that in the back? Okay. Just a brief summary as we're bringing this up. This was fantastic. I know I'm in a little bit of a dangerous position being between you and lunch, so we'll try to make sure that we are as complete and comprehensive as possible in the briefing of this process and the results, but at the same time making sure that we stay as concise as possible too. This was a great project, and we really enjoyed it, and being a part of it with a lot of passion that we brought to the project, and as citizens of Texas and wanting to see a legacy of the state park system continue into the future. We were asked to do a number of things, and so we'll cover that in the agenda today. We're going to provide you an overview of what the project was about, a review of the study requirements. We'll also talk about some of our key findings, the recommendations that stemmed from that, and the strategic outcomes that we're hoping to obtain. By the way, this presentation was also delivered to the Legislative Budget Board, the State Auditor's Office, and the members of the Sunset Commission, as well as staff from the Lieutenant Governor's Office last week, and it went over very well. If you had any other comments you want to add about that,
that's well said.
Okay. So again, we want to talk about a little bit about the objective of the project. The Rider 31 asked us to identify what are the characteristics of a high-quality park system, and then to assess where we were as the Texas State Park System against those criteria. We also were asked to identify what actions were necessary to be able to fill that gap and meet the standard of high quality. We were asked to estimate projected costs and potential revenues associated with those actions, to assess public need for state parks and state park amenities. And when we did put the public need analysis, we did that to a multivariate approach. We went out and conducted numerous interviews across the state of community leaders, and those folks are acknowledged in the report, going from state elected officials to local elected officials, as well as local chamber, convention, and visitor bureau folks. We also went out and did a statistically valid household survey across the entire state that also took into account the distribution of the population in the state. Texas is unique. We heard a lot about our uniqueness today. Texas population distribution is also very unique. We have 254 counties within the state, and over 50% of our population is concentrated within 20 of those counties. And so obviously we have this has an impact on the distribution of our park system. In addition, we also took into account the findings from the recent focus groups that Parks and Wildlife has completed in the last couple of years. We were asked to estimate the economic impact of state parks, both statewide and for local communities. To do that, we also borrowed from the study recently completed in 2006 by Dr. Crompton from Texas A&M, which is a great report, and you'll see some of the key findings from that today. And then to assess which state parks should be considered to be closed, sold, or transferred out of the state park system, which was a question nobody wanted to ask, but we were legislatively mandated, so we approached that. Some of the specific requirements, again, just a quick review, high-quality park system, the condition of facility infrastructure, maintenance requirements, amenities that are available, high-demand amenities, facilities with high return on investment, the degree of recreational value that parks provide, and justification of low operating costs, parks that meet these standards and criteria, parks that could not, the cost of the upgrades, potential revenues, and then the closure transfer list, and then evaluate the economic impact. So our key findings, it really comes down to these five key findings, and these are some very bold statements, but they are the foundation of some innovative and creative recommendations that come from the report as well. The existing conditions of Texas State Parks are not reflective of a high-quality park system. Now that's a big statement, and it requires some caveat as an explanation. We define that in the report. The reason that the Texas State Park System, according to our findings, don't meet those high-quality standards is a resource issue. It is the amount of resources available to the state park system to be able to keep up with ongoing facility demands, meeting public needs. It is certainly not an issue about the intent and the quality of the staff in the state park system that are out there and working every day to make these amenities and make these sites available for public use. And we made that clear in the presentation last week. We also made that clear in the report. This is about funding and resources available to the state park system to be able to meet demands, meet evolving needs, and deal with the fact that our state parks are aged and they're being loved to death and they're not being supported through funding means to be able to deal with ongoing facility maintenance requirements. Secondly, we found the Texas State Parks are managed from a defensive position. In many cases, the department, this is not a critique of the state park management, and Walt Dabney and his staff are extremely talented and very well-skilled at what they do. This is really about being victims of circumstance. It's kind of on both sides. Both the legislature puts this department, in many cases, in a defensive posture by some of the nature of how you have to go through your funding requests and some of the other aspects that we'll get to here in a second. We made some very specific recommendations, and we talked about this a lot last week, about how both this department and the legislative leadership can work together to help remove the department from the defensive position it finds itself in the state park side. The communications and messaging about the Texas State Park System to the public and potential visitors are not sufficient to inspire action. Again, this is a resource issue. Lydia Saldana and Darcy and a lot of the communication staff here in the department are very talented at what they do and very committed to making sure the information gets out there, but they're also very limited with the resources they have to be able to get out and promote parks and park experiences to our public. One thing we've also found in working with agencies across the country, and Texas is not unique, that communications and promotions around parks and park experiences comes from a historic mantra that is outdated, and that is traditionally if we ask you to envision what a park brochure would look like, without looking at it, you could probably tell us. And that was that it was a trifold or a panel card with a map, rules and regs, hours, maybe trails, and some basic amenity listings. And what this comes from is this very traditional communications and creative mantra that to communicate about parks and park experiences is to inform the customer. Well, today what we find is that parks are competing increasingly with non-traditional competitors for people's disposable time and money to come out and spend time in the parks. And to do that, so the mantra also has to evolve. Park communications anymore cannot get away with just informing the customer or informing the public about what's out there. They have to inspire the public to be able to come out and visit the park. And that's a little bit of a shift. And so that shift also takes resource support, and we make that argument here in the report. New development at select state parks can dramatically improve the ability of the system to meet public needs as well as increase the revenue-generating capacity of the system. And finally, strategic business planning needs to be expanded to multiple management layers. And what we're talking about there is that we do business management here in the department for individual parks, and it's an evolving business plan with the state park system. In between is the regions, the park management regions, and being able to continue strategic business planning at the regional level is something that we recommend so that we can see the business plans and strategies of individual parks roll up to the regions and then roll up to the system, and it helps folks be able to manage kind of performance goals a little bit more tightly. What is the definition of high quality? There are several pages in here about the definition of high quality, but it basically comes down to these five key factors. One is it starts with a vision that's unfettered by political, operational, and financial circumstances of how a high quality park should look and feel and the value it provides to the general public. So the first way we approach the value, what is the definition of a high quality park is from the experiential component. It's if you were driving in the gate, what does it look like, what does it feel like, and what does it represent as a value to the community in which these parks are located. And the last four deal with standards, standards for how the parks are managed to provide safe, enjoyable, and meaningful experiences to all segments of the general public, not just select segments. And that helps us also evaluate how we want to distinguish and establish standards for having certain types of park amenities, such as playgrounds or picnic areas or campsites with different types of intensity based upon the population and the population demographics. We want to look at how have a standard for how parks provide value to local communities, a standard for how parks are operated and maintained, and the standards for how parks and the park system pursues development and acquisition. And we addressed all of those in the report. We'll get into it a little bit in just a second. Knowing that the Legislative Budget Board and a lot of the legislative leadership would want to, knowing that they knew we did a household survey, we expected they'd want to know a little bit about some key results that came from that, so we also wanted to share that with you. This slide turns out to be slightly small, certainly on these other screens, but what we're looking at here is the kind of the upper half of the curve. This question was question six on the survey about what are the needs out there for facilities and services. And we want to start kind of with the outdoor activity instructional programs, which we saw at 35%, indicating that there was a need, and moving up into the picnic areas and shelters at the top. Of all the amenities in between those two, only two of them stand out as areas in which we have a difficulty meeting. One is swimming pools, whereas the public always says we need more swimming pools. Recreationally, that's not necessarily an area of focus, but we recommend for state parks. That's where city and county parks play a major role. Of course, the public will constantly try to tell you that swimming pools are necessary and maybe if there's ways in which the state park system can build more or assume some. But again, we recommend that that's something that you manage responsibly with other local jurisdictions. The other issue that's very difficult is to be able to address is river and lake access. The public, as this is second from the top, the public loves river and lake access, but you can only provide so much of that as unless you're building more lakes or opening up purchasing properties on rivers to be able to do that. So we understand that that has some issues with it as well. You'll see as we take a lot of these values that come from this finding, you'll see that reflected in our recommendations for needs in certain amenity types. We also wanted to provide information on the importance, the public felt, on the importance of various actions the state park system could take to improve and expand park facilities. We thought these were all very relevant to the priorities that the agency already has, so this is a sense of validation for a lot of the strategic direction the department is going with the state park system. Develop more traditional recreation opportunities, acquire land for preservation. This is the public speaking. Improve conditions at existing state parks. Number four, provide environmental and nature education, watershed protection, local state economic development. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. Develop more outdoor adventure opportunities and increase the level of quality of park services. And this was another interesting finding that we wanted to include because this seems to be non-intuitive to a lot of folks, and that is respondents that were asked, would they support an increase in user fees for the purpose of supporting the cost of park improvements? And, you know, you would generally expect most folks would say, no, we would not support fee increases. But when you put in there that it's going towards park improvements, what we saw is the majority of respondents said, yes, if we see where our money is going towards park improvements, then we support fee increases. And so it's not, if we ask this question, would you support fee increases to improve the financial performance of state parks, we probably would have gotten a very different answer. But the fact that we're asking them if they would support it if it went to park improvements is key here. We also see this in PROS, we see this around the country in the initiatives that we do. Folks want to see how their dollar goes towards actual tangible and visible results at parks. We've helped a lot of our customers and agencies
put together and passed over $3 billion worth of park bond packages. And again, it's going towards very visibly and tangibly improving park conditions. In fact, we're very happy last night at the elections, Mecklenburg County in North Carolina, we just finished their master plan in Charlotte as the urban hub there. We put together a bond package for them, and last night a $250 million park bond package passed, 62% in that county, based upon the very same level of analysis that we performed for you. So it does work, and people really appreciate being able to understand how their money goes towards improving the conditions of the parks. So economic impact, and again, this is taken from Dr. Crompton and Culpepper from Texas A&M, the study they performed in 2006. Just a quick caveat on this study to remind you, I'm sure you probably heard the results of this study previously. This study looked at only people who were coming to solely for the purpose of visiting state parks, or primarily to visit state parks. It was not necessarily folks that were coming to visit family, and then while they were there, they were visiting state parks. So these are how state parks drive economic activity. This was also filtered out people that were from the local area, so this is only looking at the influx of out-of-area dollars to a local community. But what it says, what the findings showed, was that $935 million a year is the economic activity that's driven by state parks in 2006. And we did not adjust this for 2008 dollars. These are 2006 dollars. The estimated impact on household income as a result of that across the state was $538 million, and the estimated number of jobs created by all that economic activity is 14,061. So what's important here to note is that state parks are an incredible economic driver in our state, particularly supporting the tourism industry. Dr. Crompton left us with a quote there at the bottom of that slide, a very bold statement, but saying essentially that Texas Parks and Wildlife is the steward for a lot of the nature-based tourism that we see that the attractiveness people come to the state for, and they should therefore be recognized for that, positioned for it, and supported by it. Now we're getting into the key recommendations, and this first recommendation is we spent a lot of time on last week when we were visiting with the legislative budget board and the legislative leadership, and if there was any one single legacy that PROS and Fisher Heck would like to see come from this plan, it's this recommendation right here. And this addresses how we make funding appropriations and how funding appropriations are reviewed and evaluated and approved by the legislature supporting capital projects for the state park system. Currently, the way the funding appropriations are made, and this is not unique to Texas, this is something that we're working with a lot of agencies across the country to move towards. It makes a lot of business sense. It's a little bit of a departure from the tradition. Traditionally, and here in the state of Texas, how you make a funding appropriation request for capital is you identify your priority projects, and then you're supposed to put together some very tight cost estimates based on very loose assumptions. And you're held to those cost estimates. What happens, and this may or may not sound familiar to you, is it goes to the legislative session, and then a series of debates begin that last for weeks, months, about the legitimacy of your projects, the legitimacy of the priority of your projects, and then the legitimacy of your cost estimates around the projects. That debate, albeit healthy, results in delays and a lot of compromise, and usually ends up in a funding appropriation that is certainly well appreciated, but never enough. This process is something that we're recommending be looked at critically and changed and developed as a new process, and looking at how we reinvest in our capital assets on an annual basis, based upon a percent value of the total asset value, not including land. A lot of private industry does this. A lot of really innovative park agencies around the country do this. It starts first with how do you value your total assets. We have a challenge with trying to develop a value of the total assets of the state park system. So we put together a hybrid approach. We visited with some of the stakeholders downtown to make sure this was going to work in terms of making that met their expectations of how you would value the Texas State Park System. And this is how we did it. The first thing we started with was the evaluation provided by the General Land Office. The General Land Office does an evaluation of your facilities and structures, like your buildings. They do not look at a lot of things that are outside their scope and expertise, such as picnic grounds and campsites and a lot of underground utilities and things that cost real money and that are real assets and cost real money for you to maintain. But they provided us a base value
of which we applied to, normalized to $2,008 dollars, so we put it in the same context. And then we went out and we developed a standard program for every single major type of park asset you have, be it campsites, picnic grounds, playgrounds, boat ramps, fishing piers, bunkhouses. We had over 35 different types of assets. And we went to a professional cost estimator and got a 2008 capital replacement cost for each one of those assets. And then we applied that to your inventory of assets. We combined these two values and got an estimate, a very conservative estimate, that the total value of assets in the state park system is $808 million. That, we know that's conservative because we have 93 state parks in the system, and we know that it costs at least $20-30 million to build one. And so we know that the real value of assets in 2008, in real 2008 capital replacement value, is probably closer to $2.4, $2.7 billion. But $808 million was an estimate we could pull together, we could easily defend and substantiate, and it was conservative, we recognized that. The industry best standard right now is 4-6% of an annual reinvestment in your capital. If we apply, at the bottom end, 4% to $808 million, that is a $32 million annual reinvestment in major capital replacement and repair for the agency, which equates to a $65 million biannual appropriation request. This appropriation request would be for major capital repair and minor repair. We also made a recommendation that the minor repair approach and how minor repair projects are defined and managed within the state be critically reviewed. Right now, minor repair is anything that's $25,000 or under. It's very difficult to do any kind of repair with $25,000 anymore. This is something that the legislative leadership is open to. They're looking at. They're getting a lot of pressure and requests from other agencies as well. We recommend that minor repair be reconsidered to be $100,000 or less. And so minor repair, major capital, repair and replacement that does not include acquisition, nor does this include new development. What this would do is have a standard appropriation methodology you could use and that the legislature could easily evaluate. Instead of getting in and debating very specific projects and cost estimates, you can make a standard appropriation request. And then if Scott and his team get $65 million that biennium to work with, he has his own methods for being able to prioritize projects within that and use that money as far as it can go. It helps us also get away from this futility of trying to identify at every session this gigantic number of deferred maintenance as a number that changes every day. What is the point? Unless somebody's going to sweep down and come up with a $400 or $500 million bond package today to take care of all of it, it's very difficult to be able to spend a lot of resources substantiating that in such a dynamic number. So what we do not recommend is we lose sight of the whole picture. The whole picture is very important. The whole picture of deferred maintenance is critical to understanding how we're gaining ground. But at the same time, we want to recognize where resources can be best spent, and that's focusing on a year or two at a time. Do you have comments you want to add to that?
I think the only thing that fell out of the conversation with the legislative leadership last week is probably not on this slide. I think it gets addressed later, but there was confusion. Is that this does not envision us catching up with the major backlog. This recommendation is related to an assumption that if you don't want to fall further behind, this is a model to keep us from getting further behind. So with this very conservative estimate of $808 million, if you apply the 4% industry standard, you're talking about $32 million a year in order to keep from falling further behind. It does not address the critical backlog. And, as Brian suggested, we do think it is largely able to continue to try to gin out a $400, $500, $600 million number because those numbers change dramatically and we have never had any opportunity to address that large of a backlog. But he's going to talk about the backlog in a minute, but I just want you to understand this is to stop the bleeding. Mm-hmm. And there's another issue, another recommendation relevant to the backlog that we have.
So Scott's exactly right. This is founded on the assumption that we're starting with a high-quality park system. This is about maintaining a high-quality park system, not necessarily obtaining one from an aged and deteriorated system. So, and also a little bit of background on where this came from. Besides being an industry best practice, we're trying to help a lot of agencies around the country move to. The State Park Advisory Board here in this department had kind of a leg up on us. They had already kind of floated out there with the LBB and with the legislature and with you that it was needed to have, necessary to have $25 million a year go towards helping us keep up with facility needs at our parks. Well, in visiting with George Bristol and a lot of the folks on the advisory board, what we wanted to do here was substantiate that. Where did that come from? And so we went through a method of substantiating it and found that they were pretty close, but we actually think it should be closer to 32. So additional key recommendations, and that are how do we meet unmet recreational needs or develop new assets to meet demand and increase revenue generating capacity. We look at how we're going to develop new assets selectively. We want to look at which needs we feel like are not being met. There are seven basic needs that we found that folks indicate that there's a lot of room to be able to grow into. First of all, picnic areas and shelters, group facilities, upgraded campsites. When we put upgraded campsites, we're generally talking about upgraded utilities at campsites, so transitioning from 30 amp to 50 amp service to deal with in RV campgrounds, to deal with the growing size of our RV equipment. Cabins are huge. Because a lot of folks who are not in the position to be able to afford an RV, but also don't have the desire to go camping in Texas in the summer, are looking for some type of middle ground, and cabins do it. I think this agency can easily share the fact that its cabins have a backlog. It's very difficult to get into cabins, which is a great indication of the demand. Youth facilities include additional playgrounds from a basic level, but also includes looking at facilities that are appropriate for our value set as a state park system, but also appeal a little bit more to youth. So, and common examples, I'm not recommending that you go out and build a whole bunch of these, but common examples on a list that you could choose from include things like BMX bike area, or mountain biking areas that are a little bit improved. So looking at how you can increase the opportunities to appeal to a younger generation is also important. Hike and bike trails. There are two projects in particular we'd like to commend the department on. That is the trailway in and around Catrock Canyon, the trailway in and around Mineral Wells. These are great projects. Hopefully you can continue to pursue connectivity between parks or connectivity between parks and local communities, because this is something we're seeing around the country. It's extremely popular. I'm visiting with Ernie Leffler, who's the general manager of the Chamber of Visitor Bureau there in Fredericksburg. You know, you don't have a lot of opportunity necessarily to increase the size of Enchanted Rock or to build another Enchanted Rock, but Enchanted Rock is a very popular park that gets closed down around 2 o'clock, between noon and 2 on the peak season, because it reaches capacity. They can't take any more. Ernie gets all those people back in Fredericksburg, and they're upset because they couldn't go to Enchanted Rock. But a trail system, a nice trail system in and around that area, very well might be able to serve their needs. And so looking at opportunities like that is one of the recommendations. Programs is the final area, which both outdoor adventure programs, educational programs, the outdoor family program that Mr. Dabney's putting together and launched with the introducing folks to kind of the skills, basic skills of camping, is a great example of this. And I think the participation in that and the feedback you're getting supports the popularity of that type of stuff. The next recommendation is about acquisition. Again, I apologize, some of these numbers are fairly small. We started the acquisition at question with when is enough enough? If you base, you know, the traditional method of basing park needs is acres per thousand population. This came from economists and sociologist Peter Druckmann, actually, many decades ago. And NRPA, the National Recreation and Parks Association, has picked that mantra up, and they've written for a while. The national standard was 10 acres per thousand, and it tends to grow. What we've looked at now is that actually the evolving methodology of looking at this is at levels of service. And the way we did that is we broke the state park system into different types of parks, because not all parks are equal. nor are they the same. You have the regional park is a basic state park unit. All state parks are a regional park, and that fact that they serve a region larger than just a local community. The next layer of park is a signature park. What distinguishes the signature park from a regional park is that there's overnight facilities available there beyond camping, such as cabins or bunkhouse group facility, and usually there's also other types of services available. A state natural area, self-explanatory, as well as state historic site, and a special use area, which is those amenities that really are those sites that really don't fit into any of these categories. And examples include Weiler Aerial Tramway and Sheldon Lake. So we looked at applying standards to each different type of park, but not universally across the state. We talked about the population distribution being a little skewed. And there's also this other issue. You have a park region in particular, Region 7, which is the Texas Hill Country, does not have a major population center, has a very low relative population to the other park management regions, yet it's one of the most popular park regions, park destinations within the state. So the demand for parks within that region is very high. In addition, a lot of the environmental sensitivities of the habitat in that area are also very high. So we couldn't just go with a one-size-fits-all standard of acres per thousand for each different type of park across the state. We had to unique defy it, make that word up, to each region. And so this is how we ended up. And we also had to put that in relation to other parks within the state. I don't know if you were aware, there's 220,000 acres of city and county parks within the state of Texas. And so the state park system should not be looked at to try to bear this burden alone. In addition, there's several million acres of federal lands which are open for public access and recreation. So we put all that in context. Our recommendation is that within this table, and it results in, by the year 2020, an acquisition of 51,000 acres across the state. And I want to provide a couple of numbers to put that again into context. That's by 2020, that's not by today. And it also is built to support the recommendations that came out previously about 5,000 acres around each of the major population centers in the state. This is helping us understand, well, what types of parks and exactly where should they be. We looked at the national standards that we referenced earlier from the National Recreation and Parks Association. We applied it to Texas. And it came out that maybe we should acquire 188,000 acres. And we looked at if we maintain our current level of service, and we continue and we extrapolated that across the growing and estimated populations of the state, it came up with we should acquire 207,000 acres. We felt like these numbers were outside of political realism. And they also didn't represent a strong balance in the system. So we landed on some recommendations that we felt like created that balance, that put the department in a great posture for acquiring land in the next 10 years, at the same time, without trying to take on more than we can chew. Should anyone add to that? So moving from acres to assets, this is a chart of all the assets you have across the entire system, and the columns are the 2008 inventory, and then the 2010 needs based upon the estimated population in 2010, the 2020 needs based upon the 2020 population, and under the assumption that all the 2010 assets were constructed, and then what the resulting inventory would be in 2020. And then we also looked at what was the representative percentage growth in inventory. The seven key assets that we are recommending that grow in terms of the largest growth of inventory include natural surface trails, all we hear anywhere we go. That looks very important to people. I think you probably know that as well. Cabins, full service cabins and limited use cabins, as well as screened shelters, overnight group facilities, group recreation facilities. And so there's some other great examples of amenities that we feel like should represent kind of the leading edge of asset inventory growth. So where does all of this get us? And we're asked to look at these capital cost estimates. We went state park by state park. In this plan, every single park has a recommendation about very specific capital projects we recommend within the next 10 years to meet evolving recreational needs and to meet the standard of a high-quality park system as we defined it. We broke those into three categories: improving existing conditions, recommended upgrades, and then recommended new developments. And then we broke that out across the different park management regions.
What you see here is that we recommend the total capital figure here for us, and this is a very conservative estimate, which is also kind of a snapshot in time, and does not necessarily include, definitely does not include land acquisition, nor does it include sometimes land acquisition necessary to make recommended developments. Does not include upgrades to infrastructure necessarily to support the upgrade or the development. So there's a lot that's missing from this, but it should give you some type of general sense of scale about where we stand. $436 million is what we looked at. Recommendations in the key in business and management practices. Enhanced maintenance of facilities. This is, again, a resource issue. The zero-based budgeting process that Walt and his team are going through is absolutely landmark. They should be commended on the progress and the process that they're going through, and that should continue. The increased usage of key facilities. Not all facilities produce great revenues, but there are some that do. Cabins are one. RV campsites or others, group facilities or some. So instead of trying to go at increasing use across the board, let's start first with trying to increase use very targeted on certain key facilities. Diversified facilities programs and events, improved marketing communications. Again, that's a resource issue. Consistent and formalized partnership. The agency has done a great job and a kind of a standard approach to engaging the private sector in partnerships. But we feel like you've gone as far as you really can with that. But there's a lot of opportunity that's possible out there for you to crack open new ways to engage the private sector, to help share the burden and helping and become involved in providing facilities and services at state parks. We do not believe this is a silver bullet that will solve all problems, but it is certainly going to be a great contributor and a great partner in the end. A good example is we put together the plan for Dallas, the City of Dallas Parks and Recreation, the Renaissance Plan, that recommended $800 million in recreation, in parks and recreation facilities, service upgrades and improvements. They put together a bond package of almost half a billion, that's $500 million, and the private sector came out to the tune of the rest. And so there are ways to be able to engage the private sector beyond, above and beyond the traditional ways in which the agency has done it up to now. Improving the positioning of the state parks as a community and economic development asset. This will help us both downtown and with the private sector, as we understand parks are more than just places for folks to go recreate. A lot of times they're community center. The city manager of the town of Mathis, in which Lake Corpus Christi State Park is located, shared with me in his interview, if it weren't for the state park, my town would dry up. And we should be commended for that across the board. So being able to position and champion the state parks as the community and economic assets is critical. Customer fulfillment. Not just retention, but fulfillment. There are three parts to an experience. Being able to, the anticipation of the experience itself, and the nostalgia. Parks and Wildlife does a pretty good job of front two, and that is getting folks engaged to come out to the parks, preparing them for their park experience, and then when they're there, the park services and the facilities, they're pretty good. Which is where we miss the boat is in the customer fulfillment side, and that is being able to help manage the nostalgia and return visits. We have a tremendous amount of contact information of folks that are coming out and making reservations to stay at our parks. This is a database that we can use to reach out to folks via a postcard, something simple throughout the year to remind them what great time they had at our state parks and encourage them to come and make another reservation to return. I think you'll see great responses from that. And finally, as we mentioned before, layered strategic planning throughout the system. But finally, the question nobody wanted to answer in all the 25 interviews I conducted around the state, from literally El Paso to Tyler. This was when we asked, do you feel like there are criteria that should be considered for state parks to be sold, transferred, or closed? We very rarely got a straight answer. This is a difficult question to, and folks downtown also recognize this. As it's easy for us in a closed room or a vacuum to identify maybe a small set of parks that should be considered, and the moment we take it public, it is a firestorm. So the way we looked at it is there should be standardized evaluation criteria for consideration, and we provide some of those in here for you to consider. We also wanted to pay homage to the fact that since the year 2000, the state park system has reduced in size by 26%. This is not a front in which you have been quiet on for the last 8 years. You have been effectively reducing the size of the state park system, both progressively by your own strategic decisions as well as by legislative mandate in the last 8 years to the tune of almost a third of the size it was nearly a decade ago. So let's recognize that as well. This is not something that you shy away from. That includes 15 state parks and historic sites that were transferred from the provisions of House Bill 2108 of the 76th legislature. Now, we've done, none of these parks were closed, by the way. All these parks are open and maintained for public recreation. This was a, these provisions allowed you to be able to upgrade the facilities to a condition in which it was responsible to hand it over to a local jurisdiction. And you did so, and you've done so very successfully. The challenge for that is that it takes a willing local jurisdiction, and those are few and far between. The last thing was that it also includes the divestiture of 18 state historic sites last year to the State Historic Commission. So we did provide a list of parks that, you know, could be looked at for evaluation. We do not recommend they get sold, closed, or transferred. But they are a list of parks that, again, we don't recommend that they cease being open for public access and public recreation, but they can be considered to be transferred to a local jurisdiction if that jurisdiction is willing. The strategic outcomes we want out of it, we want to be able to improve the ability of the state park system to meet public needs now and into the future. We want to elevate the status of the state parks to a high-quality system. You know, the county judge in Bandera told me this. He said, and I heard this from other folks as well, if we could just get our state park system back to the glory it was in the 60s and 70s. There is this memory, this institutional memory of a great state park system that we've had in the last 20 or 30 years. But the starving of the system through limited funding resources, because you're competing against all other types of requests for state funding, has put the park system in a deteriorated it to a level that it's not necessarily meeting those standards anymore. And so we know how to do it. We know how to do it right. We were there before. It's just about getting back there. Repositioning them as viable assets, strengthening them as destinations, creating and improving earned income opportunities, and eventually all that will result in improving the value of the experience to state parks to visitors. One comment that we left the folks with in the session last week was that we feel strongly that this state park system needs a campaign. It needs a campaign that engages the public, that is the idea of the policymakers, and the result of your blood, sweat, and tears. We've seen this work in the state of Washington. In celebration of the 100th anniversary of the state in 2013, they put together, I guess, about 5 years ago, because it was a 10-year plan, the Centennial Plan. And that mobilized millions of dollars out of public bond and referendum issues supporting state park improvements. The community came out in droves. Mecklenburg County last night came out in droves celebrating a campaign around renovating the parks. Dallas did the same thing several years ago with the Renaissance Plan. So we believe that the state park system is ripe for a campaign, and we kind of leave you with that big mess. But nonetheless, we feel pretty passionately about it. We hope this has been informative. It was over 1,600 pages of data that we crunched into this report and tried to squeeze into 30 minutes of a briefing to you, and hopefully we delivered on that.
Mr. Chairman, you did a good job.
Commissioner Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Commissioner Parker.
I have one question. Can we keep this guy on January the 1st?
Any further funding? Take him over to the
on a daily basis, yes.
Yes.
Excellent question.
It's a great presentation.
He does.
Yes,
you said you presented the same, made the same presentation to the LBV last week or week before?
Yes, sir.
How were you received? Kicked out? Or?
No. You know, we found actually the LBV in particular is very interested in trying to find new innovative ways to work with the agency and improve the ability of the agency to work with the legislature. So we found them to be very engaged. We spent a lot of time on that 4% issue, clearing up, you know, a lot of assumptions that could be made. Is this all you need? Is that it? You know, we make sure they understood, no, that's not it. It goes from the assumption that we started with a high-quality park system. It just keeps us from falling further behind. We talked a little bit about acquisitions. We talked a lot about public need. A lot of head nodding. I felt like it was a very supportive environment. Do you have other comments?
thought it was generally supported, Commissioner. I mean, there's a little skepticism here and there. One point that's probably important for the commission as you go into the session is to understand that we were not mandated vis-a-vis Rider 31 to go out with an out-of-the-agency study. We were mandated under Rider 30 to do so. We made the decision because we wanted an independent arm's length opinion about what it would take to get a high-quality state park system. And I will tell you that from the commission and the executive office's perspective, we stayed out of this study. We did not impose ourselves on Pros Consulting and Fisher Heck. You can get verification from Ryan. I did not very often attend these meetings, and we did that on purpose. We wanted this to be an independent study that was not driven by the agency, but was driven by the expertise that these folks brought to the table. So we think this is a good study. I think it does support many of the arguments we've been making over time. I think there will be skepticism in certain corners.
In your presentation and your study, did you have any recommendations or ideas on a campaign? Or is that?
That's a great question. And no, we didn't. We didn't provide. We didn't want to put the department in a. We didn't want to pigeonhole the department there. That's something we feel like you need a lot of latitude to think through. We just feel like one is necessary and has a high probability of working.
Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you.
Brian, and I assume that recommendation is also predicated on the fact that we've had so many successful local ballot campaigns throughout the state that have passed overwhelmingly in terms of support for parks and green space and open space and water quality lands.
Absolutely. We've seen that here in the state of Texas. Generally, the public is somewhat naive and takes for granted the true costs of maintaining great park systems. But when they are confronted, they're a very intelligent public, when they're confronted with the real costs, then they generally step up to the plate overwhelmingly. As a good example, 2 months ago I was in Flagstaff. I'm wrapping up the master plan for Coconino County, which is the second largest county in the country and includes the Grand Canyon for the county park system. And their parks, they only have 6 parks in that county, but they've accumulated $35 million in deferred maintenance because they have starved that park system of the necessary funds to meet facility needs. Well, this was a sharp point for the county commissioners. And the chair said to me when we presented the findings of just the assessment of facilities, she said, man, this feels like a shot between the eyes. I said, well, you can perceive it like that, but it's really meant to be more of a shot in the arm to the community about the realities of where your facilities are and what you need to do about it. They opened it up for public comment after the findings report, and 5 folks stepped forward. 3 of them verified that they felt like the facilities were in that state of affairs and something needs to be done about it. 2 other folks stepped up and asked them to please raise taxes so that they could do something about it. That's not unique to Flagstaff, nor do I feel like it would be unique to Texas based upon what you're saying, Carter, on the success of local initiatives. Folks, when they're faced with the realities, they get it, they understand it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.
Very good.
I did it. Mr. Chairman, recess the Finance Committee and turn it over to my able colleague in the Conservation Committee, Chairman Bivens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may add one aside, Vivo acknowledges the need for said Red Raider to trumpet his singular and infrequent achievement. I would like to call the Conservation Committee. The first item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes. Entertain a motion for their approval.
Second.
Moved by Hickson, second by Brown. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Now moving right along. The Conservation Committee items 14 and 15 will be discussed in executive session. We will now recess for executive session. Therefore, I'd like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551071 of the Open Meetings Act. We are adjourned to executive session.